Well, committee to order.
I've got this order in name tape.
You get there, Ernie.
Well, thank you for the.
What do you got, Mary?
That's not me.
We're going to hear Representative Chair Mahoney's bill.
Would you like to call the committee to order?
I just did. The committee is committee has come to order. We're going to be hearing House File 2384, Chair Mahoney's bill. And the intention is to lay the lay over the bill for possible inclusion. Chair Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr.
To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to call down, a friend? Is it a from, okay. Members of the committee, this House File 2384, last year, Allina Health Systems purchased, I guess that's the simplest way to call it, the Sister Kenny, correct? Yes. And we had, in order to allow them to continue to receive state vocational rehab monies, we had to kind of swing something in on the last minute. This is trying to take it in and make it permanent. So with that, I'd like to let my testifier explain a little bit and answer questions.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney. Would you please introduce yourself?
Good afternoon. My name is Kimberly Peck. I'm Director of Vocational Rehabilitation with Services with DEED. The bill that Representative Mahoney is putting forward today is essentially a bill to address a technical issue that came up upon the point in time when Courage Center merged with Allina Healthcare System. Courage Center has been a provider in the extended employment program with DEED for many years and has had outstanding outcomes for us. However, the extended employment program is governed by Minnesota rule and statute, and in the statute that defines a rehabilitation facility, it limits rehabilitation facilities to those entities whose primary purpose is to provide employment services to individuals with significant disabilities. When Courage merged with Allina, that no longer fit. So it was at the 11th hour, literally last session, when we discovered this issue and put forward a request, which was passed, to extend the opportunity for Courage to continue to participate in the extended employment program for 1 year. What the bill that Representative Mahoney is presenting is to continue that extension another year. And the reason that that's being proposed is that the Olmstead plan directs DEED and Vocational Rehabilitation Services to undergo a rule-making process to update the extended employment rule. And we're expected to have that work completed by July 1st of 2015. So the definitions will be addressed in the rule promulgation process. And so our recommendation from DEED to Allina was just to continue the extension for another year, as the issue will be fully and completely resolved in the rule process.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee to the testifier? Thank you very much. Chair Mahoney, do you have any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair, at this time. There are other people in the audience that could answer questions if they arise, but I don't see this as an issue that we need to spend a lot of time on.
Okay, if there's no further questions, then we'll lay over the bill for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Next bill will be House File 2949, Representative Purcell.
Give a briefing, you can do.
Thank you.
This is the office. Oh, man. Which is the handing it out right now.
Okay.
Is that Tim Trotz? Right. We know that's what he's got. I will talk to Connie.
If you need any help.
Well, yeah, say something.
Representative Purcell, welcome to your committee. Which is your bill? House File 2949?
Yes, sir.
And would you like to refer that to the General Register?
If that's the appropriate path, yes. That's fine.
Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself and explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative John Purcell, and bring before you today House File 2949. And we do have an amendment that was, I believe, handed out now. And like that for consideration, we can have further explanation of that amendment as needs be.
Representative Purcell, would you like to move the A14 amendment to get it in the shape that the author would like?
I would so move, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. I don't know the exactly what it means, but I'm sure Rick, one of the two testifiers would be able to explain it.
That would be good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Craig Gustafson, the Chief Unemployment Law Judge at Deed. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the A14 amendment simply reverts back to existing statutory language regarding applicants filing continued requests for benefits. That section refers to electronic transmissions. When our legal counsel drafted that change, we did not anticipate that electronic transmission also includes our phone systems. Currently, online, if you come in and request benefits each week online, we can handle any capacity, say on a Monday morning, our busiest time. When the law was adopted, we were asking for certain times for applicants to come in each day. Now online, we can take everybody on one day, but on the phone system, we don't have that capacity yet, and so we're concerned about our phone system being overwhelmed. So this just allows us to continue designating dates and times for people to call in and request benefits by phone.
Are there any questions about the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A14 to get it in the shape that the author would like, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, same sign. The bill is in the shape that you would like. Would you care to go over your bill? We have a fairly lengthy discussion on the next bill, so brevity might be appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'll certainly keep my part of it brief, and then we can go over the bill. I'll have Mr. Caligiuri and/or Mr. Gustafson available for that. Just a little bit of background for committee members. This House File 2949 is Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council's policy and housekeeping bill for 2014. That council, the bill is a product of the council. The council is made up of the Minnesota Chamber, contractors, labor, and there's also four Minnesota senators and four representatives on that council. So what we have here is the product of those deliberations, and I would just ask now if Mr. Caligiuri, if you want to go over the high points of the bill, and we'll try and abide by the chair's brevity request.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Caligiuri. I'm the Director of Unemployment Insurance at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And this is a
right,
bill.
Before you go any farther, you know, the chair just had his cell phone ring, so everybody should really follow the lead of the chair and avoid the embarrassment and turn yours all off. So if you have a cell phone, please turn it off or put it on silent. I apologize for the interruption, but please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, this is the UI bill. It's primarily, it consists of technical changes. There are some policy changes as well. And this bill has been through the process of going through the UI Advisory Council. Again, there's a broad representation of folks who are interested in UI policy on that committee, been vetted with that committee. I think the two major things that are on this bill are first of all, we're seeking to lower the interest rate that we charge in both individuals or applicants who have committed fraud and have an overpayment, as well as employers who fail to report their taxes. And we're seeking to reduce the interest rate from 18% to 12%. It was set at 18% in the early 80s when interest rates were very, very high. And prior to that, it had been 12% for about 30 years. You need a fairly significant interest rate in order to induce individuals to pay us back. And in checking across the country, I think 12% is pretty much the standard or the most the interest rate used by most states. So we're seeking to reduce that interest rate. The other major thing here is we're reducing the amount of time we require employers to keep payroll records. We're reducing that time limit from 8 years to 4, so there is a significant probably paperwork and administrative burden that is being lessened here for employers, but those are the two major things. If the committee has any questions, or Craig, why don't you go over any of the other things that are legal and
okay. Mr. Chair, members, in addition to what Mr. Caligiuri just described, other sections in the bill include a
Mr.
change
Gustafson,
in the...
Mr. Gustafson, if you could identify yourself.
Yeah, sorry. Mr. Chair, Craig Gustafson, Chief Unemployment Law Judge with the... Mr. Chair, members of the committee, other sections include a change in the standard of ownership for employer experience rating, history transfers, a clarification on severance pay as it affects eligibility for benefits, an exemption for attorneys from certain types of online filing requirements, and the exclusion of non-qualified stock options from counting as wages when exercised by a former employee. Article 2 in the bill is technical and housekeeping. These sections simply eliminate unnecessary language, make the statute easier to read and understand. Several of the sections are included to improve the organization of the statute and to repeal unnecessary and outdated statutes and administrative rules. And Mr. Caligiuri and I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
So are you including your unsession kind of language in this particular bill?
Mr. Chair, a lot of the sections are in the spirit of the unsession, but we do have provisions in the unsession bill as well. But
okay. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Albright.
for the testifier on line 3.1, I'm not sure who wants to take a nab at this, but under the definition for wages, you are suggesting to include income that is the result of an exercise of non-qualified stock options. Is that only at the time of exercise, or is that construed as when they vest?
And who would like that one?
I'll take that one, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, that's actually an exemption from the definition of wages. If you look, that's a list of things that are not wages. If you look on page 1, line 27, the key word at the bottom is except, and then we have a list of things that are not considered as wages. That provision came to us because of simply one case where a former employee was exercising stock options. The employer was properly reporting those as wages, and this employee would re-qualify for benefits every year simply by exercising stock options. And so we're simply closing that loophole, Representative.
That answers my question, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions on this particular bill? Seeing none. Representative Purcell, would you like to renew your motion to re-refer to the General Register?
Renew that motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All those in favor of House File 2949 to the General Register signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. You are on your way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Purcell. Mr. Chief Justice. Yeah. All right. Representative Sundin.
I just want to compare notes.
Sorry, I wasn't clear.
Yes. Welcome to the committee, Representative Sundin. You have House File 1984, and this bill is heading towards the General Register?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right, so Representative Metzler, would you like to make to move Representative Sundin's bill?
To protect the people like this, yes.
You should use the microphone.
To protect the people like this, yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Would you care to make the motion to re-refer to the General Register?
Yes, I would like to re-refer to the General Register, House File 1984.
Thank you. Representative Sundin, please explain your bill and let's go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Metza. Thanks to the committee for hearing me today on 1984. This is nothing more than a consumer protection bill, and the consumer is the state of Minnesota and other government entities. This will ultimately protect people from bidders on public works that fail to perform properly, fail to pay their employees properly as prescribed by Minnesota law. And we've negotiated quite... Excuse
me. Representative Sundin, I'm not sure. I didn't see this. You have a delete all amendment?
Yes.
You do. And yes. If it... I would prefer that we get... Because it looks like it's a delete all, so I'd prefer to get the delete all in front of us before you start explaining your bill. So if you don't mind, Representative Metza, will you move the DE2 amendment?
Move it. So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. With the DE2 is the amendment that delete all amendment, which will get the bill in the shape that the author would prefer.
That is correct.
All those in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. It is in the shape that you would like. But seeing how I have you stop, I see a lot of IBEW reps. And having worked with a number of them, welcome to the committee.
Sorry.
Glad that you could be down here today. And hopefully we'll give you a brief lesson in civic discourse.
Civil or civil?
Painter. So please explain your DE2 amendment.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, and thank you again, Mr. Metzer, Representative Metzer. The amendment brings this 1984 into shape where, again, it will protect the consumer. The consumer is the state of Minnesota, other government entities. This will create an inventory of qualified contractors that we can reach out to for bidding purposes. Yeah. And if contractors do not meet the qualifications, they will not be entitled to bid on public works here. So I have with me today some of the people that have worked on this over the past 2 months, and we've got it in a really good shape. It's ready for prime time, and I'd like to bring down Harry Melander, the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council, first.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape. And
sir, Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I'm employed by the Minnesota Building Trades Council, a group that represents about 55,000 Minnesotans that are back to work because of some of the great work that you've done over the last couple of years. And some of them are in the room today, and we just appreciate putting our families and friends back to work. So with that, I'd like to comment on Representative Sundin's bill, 1984. As indicated, it's a pretty straightforward bill. It provides a mechanism for municipalities and other agencies to ask contractors that are using state money, my money, your money, people in the room's money, just to make sure that they're good law-abiding citizens. And I don't believe that that's really too much to expect from the lawmakers that are in front of us here. This bill has been, it started about one or two pages. We've spent a lot of time talking to our construction partners, and we believe for the most part, it's not perfect, but it's pretty darn close, as indicated by Representative Sundin. You know, one of the reasons we're doing this is that public bidding laws really do not provide the tool, primarily for smaller municipalities or smaller school districts, to deal with contractors that may have business practices that none of us in the room here would support or subscribe to. So this provides that mechanism. We think it's a straightforward bill. It's called Responsible Contracting. We think it's an responsible. It's about honest people in Minnesota using taxpayers' money, and we would encourage the committee to move it forward so that we hopefully can put it into law.
Thank you, Mr. Melander. It looks like you have about five testifiers, so what I'd like to do is get all the, through all the testifiers. All the testifiers will stick around, and we'll be able to ask questions as we as the committee would like.
Good.
So, thank you, Carl Macarios. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Kyle Macarios. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. House File 1984 is a bill that would modestly change the state's procurement statutes to ensure that when public entities are hiring construction contractors, we're hiring contractors that abide by our laws. While the vast majority of construction contractors play by the rules, it's widely acknowledged in the construction industry that there are a small number of unscrupulous contractors that skirt the law to win bids. Too often, these contractors end up continuing to violate the law on projects paid for by the taxpayers. Not only are these contractors cheating the taxpayers and often their employees, but they're also gaining an unfair advantage over in bidding against legitimate employers that follow the rules. Let me give you just a couple of examples. In 2012, a large MINSCU project at North Hennepin Community College found four contractors on that publicly funded project that had wage violations totaling approximately $23,000. Now, one of the contractors on that job had recently been the prime focus of a federal investigation by the Wage and Hour Department for a different project the year before and was found to have violated the law on that project to the tune of $370,000. A fifth contractor on that same project was found to have underpaid their workers by $54,000. That's a total of $77,000 in wages owed to workers, underpaid to workers on one project with contractors, some of which had been found with similar violations in recent history. A similar problem, the city of St. Paul recovered $48,000 for workers on a publicly funded project in St. Paul. A year later, the same contractor was found with identical violations on state DNR and historical society projects. This is how this bill will attempt to solve the situation. We're asking in House File 1984 that contractors that bid on work from state or local governments will have to sign a statement under oath that they meet a set of minimum criteria. All of the criteria are current law. They'll have to verify that they comply with and have not had any recent major violations of these laws, such as requirements to pay workers' compensation and unemployment and to have a tax ID number. They can't have had major violations of a series of wage and hour laws, including overtime, child labor, and prevailing wage requirements. They can't have violated a municipality's requirements for payment of wages on a recent contract. They must abide by laws prohibiting illegal subcontracting schemes, payroll fraud, and employee misclassification. They can't have current tax liens. They can't have operated under a false front as a disadvantaged business. And they can't currently be debarred by the federal government, the state, or any local government. We've tried very hard, worked with a lot of contractors and contractor associations to craft this bill so that there's very minimal administrative burden on either legitimate employers or on public agencies. Contractors simply have to sign a statement that they meet these criteria, and the public agencies only have to receive it. If it turns out that a contractor submits a false statement, then they're in breach of contract and are ineligible to work on public projects for 3 years. You'll hear from some contractors in a minute, Mr. Chairman and committee members, that we've been working closely with. The DE amendment in front of you represents a lot of compromise on our part with these contractors and contractor associations, primarily around the areas of making sure that responsible contractors, legitimate employers, good contractors that make administrative or technical errors are not triggering any violations under this law, that only contractors who commit kind of major violations as delineated in this bill would trigger violations here, and around reducing the liability of general contractors, specifically for the subcontractors in a number of areas. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for your time, and I'll be back to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you. I think the third testifier is Matt Marquinez.
Marquise.
Good, we got them lined up.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Matt Marquis, and I represent five different subcontractor associations: the Carpentry Contractors Association, the Minnesota Drywall and Plaster Association, the Minnesota Environmental Contractor Association, the Minnesota Floor Covering Contractors Association, and the Minnesota Painting and Wall Covering Employers Association, with over 100 total contractors and thousands of employees in the state of Minnesota. As Mr. Mercario has indicated, we have worked really hard with them to come up with language that we found agreeable. We find that this is still a large issue, and we hope that you pass this bill into law.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Thaden. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association and the Minnesota Contractors of the National Electrical Contractors Association. Between those two associations, I represent 300 subcontractors throughout Minnesota doing electrical, plumbing, heating, and air conditioning work. Although, seeing all the red shirts, I'm wondering how much electrical work is getting done today. We support this bill. Thank you.
Revy, I like that. I think, thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. Mr. Werke? I think the Bill Rames is next, so he may as well make his way towards the witness table.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Tim Werke. I represent the Associated General Contractors. We're the state's oldest and largest construction trade association. A good share, if not the majority, 80 to 90% of our members are union prime contractors. We maintain the relationship between employers in the union business model. And I want to start by thanking Representative Sundin and our partners in the building trades for accommodating the concerns that we have had as this bill has been developed, and it's been a great working relationship with them. The product you have in front of you is a good product. We are still working to put the final brush up on it. And we would be able at that time to support the bill fully. There are just a few minor related issues that we hope to clean up and work towards in the coming days with our partners, and we believe that there's a path forward for being able to do that. We have a framework for that. It simply comes down to the fact of getting the right legal minds in the room to review the actual words on paper and get to that point. So at this point, I want to commend the author and tell you that the bill is moving substantially in the right direction, and we look forward to being able to support it fully.
Thank you, Mr. Werke. Mr. Ray.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Phil Raines from Associated Builders and Contractors. Much like AGC, we're a large trade association representing general contractors and subcontractors throughout the state, whereas the massive His membership has union agreements. The Mass of Our Association does not have union agreements, though we do have some. We appreciate definitely the direction that this bill is going. It has improved a substantial amount since it was first introduced, and has taken in some of the advice coming from the contractor associations. We still have some concerns about it, particularly in the area of prevailing wage. As they noted, most of these are tied directly to the violations. However, this does set a new standard for a prevailing wage violation and how someone would be debarred at this point. We have pushed continually that the standard should be set at willful or repeated violations. There are many inadvertent violations that good contractors going out trying to comply with this law find themselves tripped up by it, sometimes through a difference in interpretation, sometimes what their subcontractors have done. We feel that the standard of a willful or repeated violation would address each of the scenarios that were put out previously for people that are actually going and violating the law. We simply want to make sure that the good contractors who are trying to comply with the law aren't inadvertently thrown out while they go and make a back payment and voluntarily make those payments as soon as they're aware of there's a problem.
Thank you, Mr. Raines. I don't think there are any more. Do you have any other testifiers, Mr. Representative Sundin? Okay, so all the testifiers are still here. We have a couple of questions. Representative Ward, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just finishing up a little bit of reading here. The author of the bill, Representative Sundin, I support the bill. I think it's a really good bill. Thank you, John. And I wanted to ask, I've got actually a bill that I've introduced. I had a situation that I won't name the agency unless I slip up and name it. That's okay. One of my constituents actually did work for this agency on a contract deal, and the contractor, the constituent worked finished the job, but the contractor pulled out of the job and didn't pay the employees. Although that he had to put up a bond for the project, and so that money is sitting in that agency, for those kind of issues. And I was looking for anything in the bill, Representative Sundin, that talked about an employee that does not get paid due to the contractor, not paying and pulling out of the project or whatever. But I couldn't see anything. It talks a little bit about required wages or penalties, but in my scenario, it doesn't deal with that at all. Is there anything in this bill related to a situation like that or an issue like that you know of?
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, actually, under that scenario, if that employee is subject to a member of a bargaining group, he'd have recourse through his representatives there. And if not, the Department of Labor and Industry certainly has the mechanism for collection of wages that have been lost.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Sundin. I can't believe how difficult it has been to try to recover this person's wages due to him from this agency on a road project. I won't name the agency. So it's been very difficult working within the agency and Dolly and the money's there. The money's there to pay these folks, and so I was just hoping that maybe. Maybe my bill doesn't have to go forward, but you might want to check my bill out and get on it, by the way. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. Ward, but maybe you'll have to talk to the chair about getting a hearing on that bill.
Mr. Chair, that'd be a good idea.
Representative Sundin, I'm next on the agenda, on the questions list here. I've got a question for you and then for someone who can explain willful and repeated. Under this bill, is a contractor considered barred from bidding on work if they are, I'm not sure what the word would be, charged or under investigation or have found to have been guilty? What's the line they have to cross in order to be brought underneath your bill here?
The intent is, Mr. Chairman, to be found guilty. You know, people can make allegations, you know, until the cows come home, but there has to be something verifiable there.
So, Representative Sundin, how long, I mean, here's my question, then I'll ask the question this way. So if there's been a charge, how long does the investigation typically take?
That could, Mr. Chairman, that could depend on if the agency or agencies are involved, such as the Department of Labor and Industry, or if there's a grievance procedure taking place, or if the wage and hour department is doing an investigation. Sometimes that takes weeks, maybe months.
You had somebody come to the table. Did you have something to add to that? Okay. Because, you know, we do a lot of lawyer employment around here, and, you know, another way that they could appeal, that's my only concern, is if they can appeal and appeal and appeal, they can keep this off the record for a good number of years, which means you'll be back here next year, the year after next, with a way to fix that. So, now you have something to add.
With your permission, Mr. Chairman.
Go right ahead, Mr. Mercario.
Thank you, sir, and committee members. One of the major compromises made with employer associations in this bill is to make sure that their due process rights to appeal a finding that they disagreed with is included in this bill. And so specifically around wage and hour violations or prevailing wage violations, we do have in this bill the right for an employer who disagrees with a finding by the department to appeal and make sure that they have, you know, they can exhaust the process in place, determine whether or not they actually committed a violation if they have a disagreement about that.
And
but you're right, Mr. Chairman, that process certainly can go on for some time.
We have another person that wants to chime in.
Mr. Chair, Gary Thaden, I worked with Kyle and the author on this particular provision, and we were concerned about the due process rights, but I want to make sure you understand that the three-year period is still a three-year period. So if the final resolution of the issue takes place a year from now, then that's when that three-year time period starts. So it's still 3 years.
And can anyone, Representative Sundin, can anyone tell me how long the average appeal on that is? Oh, I think somebody just stepped out of the room.
Thank Mr. you. Chairman, I cannot.
Representative Gunther, did you have a question?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, to any Mr. Mercurios or the author, either one, one minor misstep from a contractor could make this contractor be disbarred for 3 years. Now, I'm concerned about the contractor, but just as much I'm concerned about the people that work for him. This is a rather severe penalty with apparently not any recourse, and I agree with the bill, don't get me wrong, but I just think the penalty just is a little bit steep.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Representative. In the construction industry, most of the workforce is mobile, so if one contractor is debarred, quite typically the workforce could move on to another contractor. So I really can't envision workers really taking the brunt of any of this.
Okay, thank you.
And before we go any farther, I'm going to ask Mr. Rakowski from the Department of Labor and Industry my question. I'm sure you had to take an important call from your boss. So
yes.
When I asked the question, how long does it typically take for an appeal on any of these particular type of violations that this bill talks about? Is it a 30-day process? Is it a two-year process? So wages or prevailing wages or I'm not picking up the other one.
That's all right.
Mr. Chairman, John Rakuski with the Department of Labor and Industry. I don't have the DE amendment in front of me, but I don't think the language changed regarding what statutes are touched. So we're talking about prevailing wage. That's where we're dealing with back wages. The so let's just stick with that. Actually, she was calling about another bill later tonight. But I did ask her, I said, I know when we first started the prevailing wage enforcement 8 years ago, those who were advocating it were kind of frustrated that the investigations were taking so long. For those who aren't familiar, it's a complicated investigation process. You're looking at payroll records from numerous contractors. So it still does take 6 months to a year. And yes, after the decision to issue the back wages is made by the department, that individual can still appeal it. So you're correct.
Thank you. Representative Uglem, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, to, I believe Representative Sundin. Just a couple of quick questions. Regarding the three-year disbarment from contracts and things, could you give me a little background on that? Why did you decide on 3 years versus two?
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. You know, there's a degree, I guess, of guilt or however you want to put it. How far back can you reach, you know, for violations, that type of thing? Our intention is never to bankrupt or harm a company. The intention here is just to make certain everybody stays honest. And we don't want to put anybody out of business permanently, but we just want to give them a good wake-up call. 3 years seems like a reasonable number.
Mr. Chair? Follow-up?
Yep.
Well, 3 years seems like a long time to me, but I think that's a little tough on some people. 2 years probably might be more appropriate. But then my other question is we are including municipalities in this bill now. How do you foresee that working out for increased costs and paperwork and things for municipalities? Is that going to be tough?
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, it's hard to measure. One would assume that there's going to be some costs up front for bookkeeping, that type of thing, but I think there's going to be a lot of cost savings when you guarantee the quality of work and jobs being finished on time. And it's hard to determine any of those numbers. You pick a number, I guess.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
One more follow up, because we've got like six people on the list.
Gotcha. Is there any further comments from carpenters?
I'd just like to say, Mr. Chair and Representative Uglem, we worked with the League of Cities on this to make sure that we are not adding to the administrative burden to public entities at all. The responsibility of the city here is to take a one-sheet piece of paper, a sworn statement by a contractor, along with all the paperwork they already do, and keep it in that file. That's the responsibility of the city. They're not responsible for verifying that everything is true. They're responsible to have a contractor sign a sworn statement that they meet the criteria and keep it on file.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for.
So if I may, just to be clear, for a municipality or a local government, all they need to do is take the one more sheet of paper. They don't have to file out forms or anything else. They just have to have that one sheet that's signed by the contractor, and they can slide it into the construction file.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Albright, you had a question.
It would be for Mr. Makarios. What would be the consideration of a competent and going concern, just make a legitimate benign error of a nature that they identify for themselves and they want to rehabilitate, and it might be clerical error. Is the incursion the cause for the penalty? Is there a rehabilitative period under which a legitimate business can fix the error?
Mr. Makarios.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. a large part of the negotiations with the contractors was making sure we're drawing lines here, right? And what is a minor technical error and what is a major violation? And so a large part of the negotiations stemmed around these very questions. And so in each of the minimum criteria, there's got to be an objective standard that a contractor would have to trigger in order to be in violation of these sections, right? So in each, there are a series of them, depending on which criteria we're talking about. And those lines are drawn in collaboration with the contractors to make sure we're doing just that, which is minor technical errors should be fine. Major errors after due process trigger a violation, and then a contractor that commits that kind of error would not be eligible to work for the taxpayers for a period of time.
Mr. Makarios, can you show me in the bill where that is?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So, for instance, we've talked a lot about prevailing wage violations. On prevailing wage violations, line 3.8, which actually probably should be 3.9, looks like the sub 2 there at the end of the line. 3.8, about 3/4 of the way across the line there is a number 2. That is minimum criteria number 2, having to do with wage and hour violations. So, for instance, on prevailing wage violations, we said any violation under $25,000 does not trigger a violation. They would have to have one or more violations of $25,000 or more, or have been issued an order to comply by the department. And then on or 3.22, it says a violation does not occur until a contested case proceeding and any appeals have concluded with a determination that the contractor, subcontractor, or related entity underpaid wages and penalties. So that's where we have the due process.
Thank you. Ms. Albright, did you have a further question?
I do, with regard to maybe a similar theme, but I'm just looking at what would happen under the if they were under audit and they were completing other bids for other large work, and at the time that the audit was, or a determination letter, let's just say, by the DOT was issued and it was their second one, would they be barred from completing the bid process on those that were already in process? Or is it only for those that they cannot be, they're barred from issuing bids on new, but they get to complete the RFP on bids already in process?
My understanding is that any violations prior to the bid date would apply, and then any work that's continuing that's already been awarded would continue to the completion of that contract. So they wouldn't, the contractor would not be removed from any job that's occurring.
Mr. Chair.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank
then
you.
I'm going to move on. I
just want to verify then it would only bar them from new bids.
Yes.
Representative Sundin. What was that, a yes?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative
Leidiger. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sundin, if the company's found if the department issues a penalty order, is that a finding of guilt? I'm going to expand on this because it's, maybe it might just be one question. I'm trying to understand a little bit better this tripwire that we have that makes the company guilty.
Okay. How about if we ask the person from the Department of Labor and Industry to explain a little bit about the tripwires that we got here?
Thank you.
Could you repeat the question, Mr. Chairman and Representative?
Well, Representative Uglum had brought this up, you know, where the department gets involved, the issuing of penalty orders and we don't really quite talk about it, but we talked about this verbally. Is that a finding of guilt, and then is that a tripwire that then the company is barred? And then I'm asking for a further explanation. Okay, what does the bill say the tripwire is?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, they would have had to pay the back wages. That's what we're going to be. We're going to get to that $25,000 threshold that's in the bill. Those would be either a total of penalties or back wages paid. When we issue the order, that's not automatic. We have it's like we're saying, hey, it's been brought to our attention that you're in violation of one of these statutes, and please give us your payroll records, and that's what begins the investigation. Excuse me for my voice.
Okay. And that's the answer to that first question, Mr. Chair, and that was the penalty orders. So when you do issue that penalty order, that's not a finding of guilt?
Mr. Chairman, no. That begins the investigation.
That begins the investigation. Mm-hmm. And
later, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for indulging me on this because it's a little bit difficult. That was the one piece that
short timers are hard to handle.
Are we really?
Sure.
Just want to get
everybody
clear.
Everybody understands what I just said.
So the penalty order then goes, and that just puts the person on notice, but there's no time clock that starts that this company may be pulled out of competition.
I think that's a question for Representative Sundin.
That's correct.
All right.
I'll let it.
All right. I have a question. I'm next on the list. I'm chair. It doesn't mean I'm any better than anybody else. I just have to put my name on the list like everybody else. Mr. Raines, I had a question for you because you were talking about willful or repeated. So I'm going to give you a couple of seconds to explain what you mean by willful or repeated because I don't understand exactly what you mean.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members. Willful and repeated is a term of art used in various sections of statutes right now, especially on, I know it through the construction codes, through OSHA, et cetera. Willful means that you intentionally violated the law or were recklessly not following the law. Repeated is, as it sounds, if you've done this in the past, and you do it again, hence you have some notice that you should be complying with this, and you go and do it anyway. This goes to the intent of the person. Are they trying to skirt around the law? If so, they should be debarred. If they just trip up over the issue, that would not trigger this law under that standard. That's also the current standard that the department currently uses to debar people.
So, Mr. Raines, is that, a term of art is always scary in a place where we're trying to make laws. So is that term of art, willful or repeated, ever been defined by a court or by an ALJ?
I am not a lawyer. Sorry, Mr. Chair and members. I'm not a lawyer. I can't point to that at this time.
Okay.
I know it's a standard that's been out there for a long time, as I said, specifically in OSHA issues, and it is actually what the department currently has a finding of and has the ability to debar people.
Now, it looks like the fellow from Dolly is
the Dolly man back. Mr. Chairman, my memory serves me in 2009 when we revisited the prevailing wage enforcement statute. That's when we put in the definition of willful and repeated, but I would refer to your
staff
house research. And as Mr. Rain said, it's been an OSHA definition for quite a long time.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Purcell, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question that kind of takes off on where Representative Ward was and having a constituent that was not paid by a, it was a subcontractor and didn't get paid. And this happened about 2 years ago now. And it brought more of a learning process to me to this whole issue, and I've been trying to understand it ever since, and it's way more convoluted than it needs to be. That's my initial assessment. But in some statements, and I believe it was Mr. Melander that, that made some statements, the contractor is to verify by signature, and there were a number of things that were said. And where I'm headed with this is this subcontractor had to go to court, try and get money back, and it didn't sound to me like there was a bond that was put up in this instance. And I had that reaction to Representative Sundin, and the prime said I'm bankrupt, you know, you're out of luck, and the guy's, you know, he got a judgment, but he's stuck. And so is that something? Are there thresholds in here for dealing with that? Is that kind of situation as well?
Representative Sundin. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Purcell, I think my understanding of that would be if there's no money there, you can get all the judgments you want, and it's not going to do you a darn bit of good. But if there's wage violations with the wage and hour department, if that applies, they can only reach back 2 years. So there, you mentioned a two-year threshold. It's pretty tough to go back any further than that. As far as any other recourse for the worker, I think the Department of Labor and Industry could weigh in on that better than I could.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Here's the situation about not being able to be paid, and there's a piece of law right now that says you're contracting with the state of Minnesota that the prime has to pay the sub. I mean, it's in law. And that was my word, a willful violation of that. But there was, I mean, I don't know if the prime got, you know, debarred or can't do business with state anymore, but that sounded like the worst thing that could happen. No penalties that I'm aware of, and I like the bill. I'm just hoping that it covers some of those things, and not to go back in time. I'm not proposing that, but that we fix some of that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the bill doesn't address that specific issue that you brought up, but there's always next year. I'll be back.
Thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm trying to decide if a contractor will know ahead of time. So it's a due process question, really. Is there an opportunity for the contractor to be able to have a day, his day in court, even though it's not court? It works.
Or hers.
Before they lose their license, or is the appeal process only after all that has happened? And then the second question I had was about prevailing wage, and because some of the issues that we're talking about have to do with violations of prevailing wage payments, and being part of the Greater Minnesota Caucus, we talk about this a lot, and there's concern that maybe in rural Minnesota there is a lack of understanding about what people must pay in certain areas and regions, and so I wanted someone to clarify for me, does everyone know in their region of the state what the prevailing wage is and it's very clear, or is it muddy and they're not sure and accidents happen that way?
I won't answer that one because I have a pretty quick and short answer, so I'll let people who are kinder and gentler than I answer that one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, thank you for the question. I want to make clear, this bill is not revoking anyone's license. We are not making findings in this bill. We are not setting up some new judicial process What we are trying to say is that the taxpayers should act like a private business would or a homeowner would, and should not hire contractors back that violated what we want them to do the last time we hired them. Mm-hmm. And so the taxpayers have laws in effect about the way contractors should act when they're on public projects, and if they violate those laws, we don't think we should hire them again. So we're not setting up any new due process system at all in this. What we're relying on is the due process that already exists in the other laws and the minimum criteria that we set up. So, I'm not sure if that addresses your question or not.
That addresses the first part, and then the second was that there appears to be some question by some that folks don't know in outstate Minnesota what the regional prevailing wage is, and I wanted you to
Who would like address to say that? How simple it is to find prevailing wage rates across the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the prevailing wage rates are set annually in the state of Minnesota, and submissions go in, I believe it's the end of April, and then those determinations are set early in December of every year. And included in every bid specification are those reference to those prevailing wage rates that are available on the Department of Labor website and in the bid specs. So there is actually no room for mistakes on that.
I appreciate that clarification, and they are not all one rate for the state. They are done regionally.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, those are done county by county, actually.
Perfect.
So those wages are very clear.
Thank you very much.
Representative Mulroy, you have a question. And then we have Metza, Fabian, and I think we're going to try and get this bill to the General Register. So, Representative Mulroy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm noticing, and we've been trying to figure out, there's an or down on 319, but the first clause from 313 to 316... Oh no, 315 is sitting there by itself without saying how that's determined. So if a contractor certifies they're not in violation, and then later there's a determination that they violated 313 to 315, is then that a false affidavit which knocks them out for 3 years? And as part of this whole issue is this going to help any, because a lot of the BAs in the industry tell me their frustration with they continually bring up violations, they go to Dolly and Dolly settles without issuing an order to comply or whatever it's called.
Representative Mulroy, let's get the first question out done first. Now,
okay.
I'm not sure where your question was in 314 through 319. So your question is what in there, and let's have an answer to that one if we can. Do you understand it, Mr. Macarius?
I'm going to give it a shot, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mulroy, if I understand you correctly, your question was if a contractor fills out the sworn statement and then is later found to have violated one of these sections, are they in breach of contract for filing a false sworn statement? And I'll just point you to lines 4.24 on the bill, which says if a false statement is made under oath in a verification of compliance with knowledge that it is false or with reckless disregard for whether it is true or false, such a false statement shall render the contractor, et cetera, et cetera. So only if they do it knowingly would they be known.
Okay.
So your second question is?
The second question is, there, if a contractor continually does this but Dolly doesn't issue a compliance order, and instead, as you well know, they have been doing an awful lot of, at least according to a lot of the BAs, just settling with back pay. That by itself, then, it seems to me, doesn't mean that they violated under this, or does it? In other words, can they keep getting away with what's been happening, or is this going to actually have some teeth?
victim. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Seller, Representative Mullery, one or more repeated violations that add up to $25,000 in a three-year period is where we've drawn that line.
So
if they're committing small violations, they don't add up to $25,000, it won't trigger one of the minimum criteria. But if they violate for over 25 and settle and it gets to $25,000, then they'll trigger.
So, trigger. Mr. Chairman, then the settlement by itself, that can trigger up to the $25,000 in the settlement. That would trigger it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moore, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right, so Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a few of my questions answered, but I did want to point out, again, the savings that I see coming for our government entities that would be this law would apply to, I think would be quite significant over the course of time. And the recourse that the Department of Labor and Industry may have to invest, you know, in these violations over time, I'd imagine, might have some savings, too. So I thank you for bringing a bill that brings Minnesota savings, Representative.
Representative Babian, you got your three.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will try to be brief. Representative Sundin, there are a few issues that seem to be unresolved that there's not an agreement on. Mr. Raines mentioned some of those. Is it your intention to continue working towards an agreement so that we can get this really buttoned down?
Up until a few minutes, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Yeah, we can put the final touch on this if need be. I truly believe this is ready for the floor action.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. and then to follow up on Representative Albright's question about the completing work, you said it's your understanding that they would be able to finish the project.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes. Any continuing work would not be halted. The intention of this bill is not to stop any work that would add undue expense or trouble for agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is that something that's expressly stated in the bill, or is that just a general understanding?
There's nothing in the bill that, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's nothing in the bill that triggers the stoppage of any work there. So.
Okay. And then, and this may be a question for Department of Labor and Industry, who determines in the language in the bill, excuse me, who determines the minor and major violations that may occur?
Who would like to handle that one? Well, we'll bring down Dolly also, but go ahead, Mr. Macario.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fabian, the determination is made in the bill. And again, we're saying a minor violation in this bill is anything under $25,000 or one that does not trigger an order to comply, and a major violation is anything over that threshold. So rather than create some judgment call from by somebody who has to do an investigation and come to a finding, what we're doing is trying to draw a line. And say anything under that line is minor. Anything over it is a violation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nope. I'm going to take precedent here. Representative Sundin, on page 4, line 23, as it results to terminating work. Actually, 4.22, starting after the first period, it states. A false statement under oath verifying compliance with any of the minimum criteria may result in termination of the construction contract awarded to a contractor or a subcontractor that submits such a false statement. So essentially, yes, there is a method to stop work, but it's if someone has made a false statement under oath. So does that answer your question, that's the one spot that it can be done?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It may do that, but I guess what I was also getting at is, let's just say hypothetically that Fabian Construction is
keep
out.
Keep talking, because we got a 6 o'clock committee meeting, and I don't want the I'm looking to get the questions shortened for my bill later tonight. So we can have a conversation a little longer here. I got about another 15 minutes.
But what I'm concerned about is in rural Minnesota, where I live, and Representative Norton made some comments about Greater Minnesota, we may have had a violation on a previous project, but we are now working on a current project. okay, and all of a sudden now we've got a road project on a county road going and somebody's doing whatever, and all of a sudden their second violation comes along, and they're in the process of doing a new project. Does that jeopardize the new project and the employees in that project?
Mr. Makarios.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian. In this hypothetical example, I think the answer is no still. The only thing that would, where we say the bidding agency may terminate a contract is if a contractor files a false statement under oath with knowledge that it is false or with reckless disregard for whether or not it is true or false. That's the place in the bill where we talk about a public entity terminating a contract with an employer, and it is they may, not they shall, terminate that contract, even under this bill.
So you're almost holding the standard of clear and convincing evidence at this particular point. There has to be evidence they lied under oath.
Mr. Chairman, not being a lawyer, I'll take your analogy, but it says that they must have knowledge that it is false or reckless disregard for whether or not it is true.
That's pretty clear and convincing.
Last one.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sundin, I appreciate that you think that the workforce is fairly mobile. It might be in the larger metropolitan areas of Minneapolis, St. Paul, in this area, Duluth, Rochester. But where I live, workforce is not mobile. And especially the office people that might be working for a company that all of a sudden is suspended from working for 3 years. This is going to have a large impact potentially on a lot of our small contractors that do work in particular in Northwest Minnesota. So I hope that we can continue working on the bill. Thank you.
Representative Albright, if you've got a very brief one, you're on the list here, but I'm going to vote right after you're done, so briefly.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify from what Representative Fabian asked, and this might be for the author, might be for Mr. Makarios, but as the bill is structured, if a contractor is under audit for a previous infraction, but is also already in the process of, in 2 points, in the process of securing a new bid or in the process of completing work under a let bid, would the completion of the analysis finding fault or an infraction, a second infraction, would the contractor then be disbarred from either completing the RFP or completing the work under a let bid?
Mr. Makario, did you get that, and can you answer that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, I believe the answer is no. I mean, again, we're not creating some large bureaucracy to monitor all this stuff. A contractor has to sign a sworn statement under oath that they meet the criteria. If they can meet the criteria when they sign that sworn statement and submit it with the bid, then there they go. And unless they had knowledge that it was false, that's all we're requiring.
Nope, we're done. You got about a 30 seconds.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
30 seconds.
30 seconds. Mr. Sundin, Representative Sundin, I'm going to vote to get this out of committee today, and I think we need to do, if you could just keep talking to the folks a little bit. I have local guys who are good, long-time, well-known, reputable folks in my town, but because the bill's just a little loose yet, I'm afraid they're going to be affected. So please keep talking to folks and see if you can't meet that middle ground on just the tiny issues left.
I'll take my 30 seconds. As a guy who's worked in the field and had to work for some people who have been, some contractors who have been less than pristine, I think you got a good bill. All those in favor of re-referring House File 1984 as amended to the General Register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign.
Aye.
You're on your way to the General Register. Thank you, Mr. Sundin, Representative Sundin, and witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We are going to recess till 6 p.m. this evening. We have a full agenda. We are going to be in the basement.
Right, Dean.
Quiet in the committee. We are in recess, and we will meet at 6 p.m. tonight in the basement office. The basement office, downstairs, whatever that is down there. So, we are recessed. I'm going to reconvene the Jobs and Economic Development Finance and Policy Committee. First on the agenda today is House File 1068, Representative Hausman. Yes. I want one of those right now. You can pass it along that way. Representative Hausman.
Are those chippers from Crookston, Minnesota?
No, they're from Candyland. But if you'd like one.
I don't know if Representative Bernie Leader has ever given any of you chippers.
There are others here, too. This is courtesy. We need to save a few for some of the late coming members.
No, I don't.
You do have a bill up a little later. This is courtesy of Representative Albright and myself. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will say very little because you have the expert here. And all I will simply say is that this is a museum of American art that has, I think, been without a home for most of its existence. It has served in many, many locations, and she may tell you a little bit about that. And for a long time, they were not publicly housed, and so in the traditional way, we weren't able to help them. But now you'll see in an amendment that if you moved the bill, you might also offer the amendment that it is no longer a City of St. Paul project, but a St. Paul Port Authority project, because that's the entity that intends to buy the building.
So, well, Representative Hausman, I have actually, in its last location, I actually was through it any number of times, so it's a great honor for me to move House File 1068 and re-refer to the Committee on Capital Investment. And then, on having done that, I am going to offer the A1 amendment. So, members, in order to get the bill in the shape that the author would like, the A1 amendment is before us. Is there any discussion? Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is in the shape that you would like.
And then, Mr. Chair, in your packet is something that looks like this, and Ms. Malcolm, Kristen Malcolm, will be testifying.
Good evening. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you very much. My name, thank you, committee members. My name is Kristen Malcolm, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Museum of American Art. I'm here to speak in reference to the project, the reestablishment of the Minnesota Museum of American Art in our capital city of St. Paul. This organization has a very long history. We've been one of the largest and longest established museums in the state of Minnesota. Going back to the 19th century, we have been established in St. Paul in a variety of different locations, but it is our goal now to reestablish ourselves as a dynamic and innovative art museum in downtown St. Paul that celebrates American art, and in specific, the art and established work of Minnesota artists. So one of the things this museum does is that it really celebrates and features the art of Minnesota artists in particular, past, present, and future. This museum has a long history of exhibitions, of relationship with the citizens of Minnesota in educational and cultural programs. We have been without a home for many, many years, and so it is our fervent goal right now to reestablish a permanent home in St. Paul. We are looking at the Pioneer Endicott Building, which is one of the great architectural gems in downtown St. Paul, built by Cass Gilbert. And so the reestablishment of the museum in an adaptive reuse situation in which we bring a dynamic art museum back into the urban fabric in a 19th century building is what we are looking forward to doing today. We hope to establish this in a location that is right on the light rail line that will be opening in June, so accessibility and diversity of our audiences is of prime importance to us, as is the reestablishment of a very important educational program that brings arts and culture to our children and our citizens throughout the state. We have a dynamic program of traveling exhibitions that go throughout the state of Minnesota as well as throughout the nation. We have an exhibition of one of our great artists, George Morrison, that's traveling throughout the country at the present time. It just finished its run at the National Museum of the American Indian, a Smithsonian Institution museum in New York last month. So our reach is here in Minnesota, it's in our capital city, but it's also nationally, and it's important for us to reestablish a permanent home. We have plans to start a building project that will be $7 million in construction and translates to 84 construction jobs. And so we are looking for $500,000 in design bonding money to help get this project up and running in this next year. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Are there any questions for the testifier? Any questions for the author?
Because it's a Cass Gilbert building, someday I think we should try to take the committee down there to see this unusual situation where we have reuse of a Cass Gilbert building at the same time we're renovating the Capitol.
I have actually more of one question. So you focus in on Minnesota art.
Yes.
What's the time?
Yes. Our focus is 19th century to the present, and we are a museum, a Minnesota Museum of American Art, so we do have a broad compass of American art with a focus on Minnesota art within that context, as well as craft. We're the only museum in the whole state that also focuses on the great craft tradition that we have with our woodworkers and our glassmakers and our potters and all that sort of thing. So
Quilters?
What?
Quilts?
Quilters, textiles, absolutely. This is something we embrace that really will be the foundation of what our strong programming is going forward. Mm-hmm. I should say that the Pioneer Endicott building of Cass Gilbert is one of the most important office buildings of this St. Paul-born architect, and so we will be featuring aspects of this architectural gem within the museum as we rebuild and reconstruct this old building for a new and innovative use.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I have a daughter that's got a master's degree in opera and one in musical theater. Are you going to have anything but quilts and paintings and sculptures?
Yes.
Are you going to have any musical things?
Well, let me tell you, we're already
doing...
She's
from Minnesota, by the way.
Yes, absolutely. Well, this is, in many ways, I see this more than just a visual arts museum. It is about a cultural and community center that we're rebuilding in our capital city. And as it is, we're doing programming that connects with music and with theater. We've got a program right now that is with McNally Smith College of Music and interpreting visual arts through music. And so this interdisciplinary nature of this art center will be another focus of what we do going forward. So thank you. Good question.
I think you've got an act to book, it sounds like.
I'll
give you my card later.
And I guarantee you I'll be there.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for the witness? Are there any questions for the witness? Seeing none. All those that I'll renew my motion to refer House File 1068 as amended to the Committee on Capital Investment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You are over to, you know, I don't know, you probably got a good author for the Capital Investment Committee, so good luck over there.
I should tell you how gentle I was with this committee. I have only had two bill hearings this entire session that I intend. One was in the housing with the same committee administrator. That was for $100 million. And this is in jobs for 500,000, so you see I have a broad range of...
Well, Representative Hausman, as someone who actually, I mean, contrary to my persona around here, I actually do spend a lot of time in museums, so I'll look forward to spending one in the one in St. Paul here. And it is nice that you have that connection between the music school right on the light rail. So good luck with this.
Thank you
I
very
think this
much.
Is great. I'm looking forward to the grand opening in 2016.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Next on the agenda will be, we're going to jump around tonight, Representative Isaacson. Yeah, well, I always want to surprise you a little bit.
Yeah, I appreciate keeping my toes. It's really nice here.
Yes. If you try to slow up the candy, you can get in trouble around here. You know, actually,
I'm living the dream. The other
option is not doing it. Correct. Better than not having a hearing at all.
That'll really speed it up.
You done?
I said this is better than not having a hearing at all.
It's true. It's so true.
Apprenticeships. Representative Isaacson, welcome to the committee.
Representative Mone, I'd like to move House File 2369 to the General Registry, I believe, right?
Would you like to go to the? Would you like to take this directly to?
Is
the
Is there floor? Other options?
You could.
What's behind door B?
You could have it included in an omnibus bill.
Done. Done. Mr. Chair, I'd also like to move the A14.
You're really starting to sound like a veteran around here.
I'd like to move the A14 amendment, if I could, please. If you'd be so kind.
No, I get it. The staffers around here. The A, which one?
A14, sir.
Same one. I have two of the same one.
Great.
All right. Is there any discussion? Any discussion on the A14 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is in the shape that the author would like. Would you like to speak to your bill?
Yes, it is affirming and life-changing, and I hope to vote for it. And I have a...
you really want to get out of here in a hurry tonight.
It's really exciting stuff. Actually, it's so exciting, I can't do it all by myself. I'm going to ask Jessica Lumen, with a very large title, to maybe walk us through the bill.
Well, just so you know, I had some additions to this particular bill that would have made it new and exciting and interesting, but I was talked out of it.
Yes, I'm aware of that, actually. Thank you.
Ms. Lumen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. Appreciate Representative Isaacson helping us with this apprenticeship bill. This is both a technical bill, which is why it's kind of long, and a policy bill to bring DLI in conformance with the federal regulations and ensure the integrity of registered apprenticeship programs in Minnesota. We've worked with all of our apprenticeship sponsors, the partners, to do two things, which is make this bill meet the federal requirements, which we are the authorized state apprenticeship agency from the U.S. Department of Labor, as well as continuing to meet the needs of apprenticeship apprentices and employers in Minnesota. Just a little bit of background on where we are with registered apprenticeship right now. As you know, we're the registered apprenticeship agency for the U.S. Department of Labor. We have been since 1974. Registered apprenticeship, as all of you know, is the formal training system that combines on-the-job training with related instruction. Right now, we have 7,674 total apprentices. About 7% of those are women, and about 18% of those are minorities. Our largest programs, and about 80% of registered apprentices are in the construction trades. The largest program itself is in the construction laborers with 2,222 registered apprentices. The non-construction programs that are our largest programs include refrigerator mechanic. We currently have 145 health support specialists registered apprentices, power line workers, firefighters, and power plant operators.
What this bill does is it brings us into federal conformance, and it's a pretty complicated bill. I'm happy to go through it section by section, although I don't know that that's necessary. But what I just want to hit is some highlights. And that includes we're changing the definitions, we're creating the state apprenticeship agency requirements, we're maintaining the apprenticeship advisory board, we are making sure that the programs themselves are providing the training that they should be providing for registered apprentices, that they have adequate training facilities and instructors to do that, and then we're also making sure that in the event the program isn't operating the way it should, that we can either get them in conformance or deregister a program that's no longer providing the training that's necessary.
I would just like to second what she said.
Thank you, Representative Isaacson. Representative Ward, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Luman, if we were not to adopt federal conformity to federal part of this bill, would we stand to lose any federal funding for that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
To our apprenticeship program, excuse me?
Sure. We do not currently receive any funding in order to administer registered apprenticeship in Minnesota. That is funded through Minnesota funds. What we stand to lose, if you will, if we don't meet federal conformity, is that we would no longer be recognized as a state apprenticeship agency, in which case then in the United States, about 26 apprenticeship programs are run directly by the U.S. Department of Labor, and the remainder are run by individual states. In the event that we didn't meet the federal requirements, they could assume the responsibility of managing apprenticeship programs in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, that would be very bad.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering what you think about. I think I heard you say that 9% of the apprentices are women. I'm wondering what you think about that and if you have any other goals in mind.
Ms. Luman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, we actually are doing a lot of effort and a lot of work in increasing the participation of both women and minorities in registered apprenticeship programs in Minnesota. We have several initiatives working with particularly our construction groups to identify better ways of recruiting and retention of both women and minorities. So we have about 7% right now, which actually, I hate to say, is actually pretty good, since the federal number is about 5%. So we're doing better than our counterparts, and we're trying to continue to increase that participation.
Mr. Chair, in addition, I would just say that legislation I was working on last year that we passed part of, and legislation we're going to have come forward as well, will be focusing specifically on including especially groups that are unemployment's higher and groups that are maybe on the margins, in that way that we can be focusing. I know it isn't germane to this bill, but we are definitely, even I am taking a look at that as well.
Jim Clark.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I didn't quite hear us. I think I heard more from Representative Isaacson about something he's going to do in the future. I'm just trying to understand. You said you're working on it. Can you just say how? I mean, what's an example of how you're working on it? That's all.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark. So we are doing a number of things, and we've got some really good projects going on. For example, we're doing a program called Construct Tomorrow, where we had 200 students come into a hands-on program in the construction trades. More than 50% of them were girls that were able to actually use a virtual painter and use a virtual welder to see what it would be like to work in those careers. And that's, again, those hands-on experiences are what we're finding is the most beneficial in terms of bringing more people into these trades. We also do a program called Under Construction, which actually is a hands-on program for high school kids where they work on building a small structure during a summer program with OSHA involvement, with apprenticeship involvement, and that has been particularly beneficial in the Hmong community. We've actually had a lot of participation from that group. We're focused in St. Paul on some of those projects. We've also done some over in Minneapolis. So we have a couple of really good projects like that, and we've learned that you really have you have to do it sort of one by one, getting the exposure, doing the hands-on experiential learning, so that people who want to be in these kinds of trades and occupations can decide whether that is somewhere thing that they want to pursue, sort of in that very early stages.
Chairman, just a follow-up. Is this a
Representative Clark, Representative Isaacson would say something too, but Representative Isaacson.
I just wanted to add, you know, part of what I think I'm very much in tune with where you're going with this, and what I would say is that I think it's important that the Department of Labor has a very clear agenda on making sure we have an inclusive policy, but I think we could both agree that really when you're talking about many of the trades that the apprenticeships are focused at right now, you're talking about a socialized pattern that starts in junior high about who's being exposed to the kind of skills they need to be allowed or even see that as an avenue. And I think that's something that you'll find in education committee. We're also very keen on understanding how to bring career and technical opportunities, pathways to those folks. So I just want to point out that, you know, the Department of Labor is kind of on the back end of solving it, and I hope we can really focus on the front end moving forward.
Representative
Clark?
Well, Mr. I believe Representative Isaacson, and I'm really glad to hear that, and I'll be glad to work with you. I wanted to ask the witness,
Ms. Roman.
Roman? Are you familiar with the Youth Build Program?
Ms. Roman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, yes, a little bit. I'm not overly familiar with it, so I don't want to speak.
It is a pre-apprenticeship program in high schools that works with the building trades, and it was established with the support of the building trades. I'm just thinking it might be something that you could plug into. If this construct tomorrow is a high school program, is it?
Mm-hmm.
You might want to check with the Youth Build Program in Minnesota. We have about 13 of them in our state, and there's folks there who are actually learning the hands-on experiences, and they get high school credits for it. And these are kids who are dropouts until they go back to a school and get going in this. So I just want to bring it to your attention. I know Representative Isaacson knows about it. So
thank you for
Representative Isaacson.
And I just want to be clear, in no way am I diminishing the role of the Department of Labor in that by saying they're on the back end of that solution. I'm saying it's a long-term issue. Right. Judging from the look of my testifier, I did not win that one. So
so noted.
Thank you.
That's fine. Thank you.
Representative Gunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Isaacson, again, I like your bill. But I tell you, it's really true that manufacturing apprenticeships, manufacturing jobs, are the ones that are most not being met today. And that's the occupation that traditionally brings us back out of any recession we're in. And I want to assure Representative Clark, Rosie the Riveter is still alive and well. And in AGCO, as well as other manufacturing plants, assembly people are very often women. And it's a very high-paying job for women. And they do a wonderful job at it. And I know the CEO of one company I talked to, he just wants to make sure that his daycare remains the way it is. So they're very excited about it.
Thank you. Any other testifiers on this bill? Any other questions from the committee? Come on down. We have another person who wants to testify here. Have a seat and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Martha Henriksen. I'm with Associated General Contractors, AGC. We're an employment association, and we represent about 200 employers in the construction industry. The vast majority of these employers are union-affiliated, and as such, they participate in at least one apprenticeship program, in many cases more. AGC is a sponsoring party to these programs, meaning that we appoint trustees and we take an active role in the leadership of these programs. I've been a trustee for about 11 years. I think it's fair to say that AGC is a big supporter of the apprenticeship model. We have we're very interested in where tomorrow's workforce is coming from. We think apprenticeship is a great way to make that happen. My experience, our association's experience, the experience of our member companies is that well-run apprenticeship programs provide a superior foundation for employees in terms of education, on-the-job training, professional development, safety, all of that. This bill, in my opinion, recognizes the importance of the role of the Department of Labor and Industry in ensuring that these programs remain held to the high standards that they have been. We think that the bill clarifies the rules, makes it easier to enforce them, provides a good process by which non-compliant programs could be deregistered. We see this as helping to maintain the integrity of all apprenticeship programs, and we fully support that and support the bill.
Questions from members? Seeing none, thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you.
And yes, and Representative Isaacson, any final comments about your bill?
I'm very excited. Let's pass this guy.
We appreciate that. And with that, we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion as amended. Representative Norton. We have House File 2933 going to hear this for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a, there was an amendment sent down, and I don't see it, so I'm just going to give an oral amendment. Page 2, line 20, it was sent down a couple days ago, and I don't, it got lost somewhere in the shuffle. So it's very simple. It just says, after the period on line 2.20, this appropriation is one time. And the same thing on line 2.23, after the period. This appropriation is one time. And I have a copy of that if you would like it. Okay?
And, excuse me, and Representative Norton, so line 2.20, we're just adding after the period, 2017?
Indeed.
This appropriation is one time.
Very and also good. On 2.23.
And the same thing on 2.23 after the period, 2017 period, after that, this appropriation is one time. Any discussion on the proposed amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The bill is in the shape you would like it. Representative Norton?
It is, and if I can have the page, there's just a couple handouts. They didn't give me very many. But I'm just going to hand this, if you could, just for the members that are there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, again, is about apprenticeships. Some of you may or may not know that I spent last summer with the University of Minnesota traveling to Germany to study the German apprenticeship program with Senator Senjum and Representative Mahoney. We are continuing that study this year and well into the future, and this issue of apprenticeships is of huge interest to me and frankly my community, who has just invented a C-Tech. It's called High School, which will be focused on getting kids ready for the workforce, and it will have apprenticeships as part of its high school focus, moving kids into the workforce. So very excited about that. So we've been working, we visited Bueller Corporation here in town. They have a very exciting apprenticeship program there, and as a spinoff of all this activity and study, Senator Bonhoff decided to move ahead with a little piece of legislation this year that doesn't actually start any new apprenticeships, but what it does is seek to broaden the scope of apprenticeships that we have in this state to add precision manufacturing, healthcare services, and information technology to that body of apprenticeships that are currently going on. And so what this bill does is, rather than create an apprenticeship program, it is asking DALI and DEED, our two departments, to establish competency standards. And so she has allocated, it does have funding, $200,000 in fiscal year 2015 for to labor and industry for the pilot program and study, and $100,000 in fiscal 2015 to the Workforce Development Fund to the Commissioner of Deed, also to develop the pilot program. So this is the first step in precision manufacturing, healthcare services, and information technology as certified and really full-fledged apprenticeships moving ahead. And I know for my community, the healthcare services is certainly one that's important. So we're trying to broaden that scope, and I think in the years to come, between what you've seen already tonight and moving ahead, you will see apprenticeship or internships, depending on how we call them, a growing interest. I know Representative Mahoney has interest as well. So that's what we're asking for with this bill. And I can field some questions, but it's pretty self-explanatory. So it's asking Dolly indeed to do some work.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Any questions for Representative Norton from members? Representative Ward.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton, thank you. It's a good bill. I really, you know, apprenticeships are, I think, a thing of our future, expanding them. And Representative Gunther's comment about the two ads besides the health care that's important to you, the other ones are important to a lot of us around the table in the legislature here, and that Representative Gunther already pointed out, the manufacturing-based program that is so, so critical to greater Minnesota, along with the IT. So good bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I'll just say, having been to Germany, they are experts in just those areas. We visited businesses that use mechatronics. It's very it's a lot of robotics, a lot of engineering, and there's so much learning that happens on the job in these businesses that help prepare that workforce, the exact workforce they need. And I think we can do that here. And frankly, on the bonding tour, getting to visit all the great colleges and through MinSCU, our 2- and 4-year programs, this is such a wonderful fit for what's happening across the state in your area and others.
Representative Ward.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Norton, you bring up a great point, you know, that you visited Germany, you and Representative Mahoney and...
Senator Senjum.
Senator Senjum. Is that where he lost all his weight?
700
You bring up a great point that they are so much more advanced than us. So do you, you know, with this bill, with this particular piece of legislation, do you see us capitalizing on that and our students quickly catching up or advancing with the German or European countries with their programs as well?
Thank you. I don't think we will ever completely adopt the German model, but I think we will have a modified version that fits our country, our unions, our businesses, and our schools. I think we have a challenge ahead of us to make certain that students know that a 2-year or certificate program, or perhaps in Germany they're 3-year programs, that is a good choice for a solid job ahead. Well, I think the message people often hear is it needs to be a 4-year liberal arts. We've kind of drummed that in for decades now, and I think we need to start sending a different message to our young people that there are fabulous jobs out there that our 2-year colleges and certificate programs can meet that need for our future workforce. So I don't think it'll be the German model, but I think it'll be something that we create that's Minnesotan.
Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Norton, you know, Ms. Hendricks and I were talking before session here, and, you know, we were talking about my past, and the thing that I ended my teaching career with was a class called Service Learning.
Mm-hmm.
And Service Learning, some of us know, is really integral in giving students a experiential education, in my opinion, out in the real world. And so, you know, apprenticeship programs are critical, but even, you know, even to the point of, you know, I even think we're starting, and I don't necessarily like the European model or other models that tunnel kids and say, oh, you're gonna become this, right? But I think that we need to give them an opportunity, we have to find a balance there that provide them with an opportunity earlier in life.
Absolutely.
That would maybe inspire and motivate our children to, you know, find the reasoning for their education. So, you know, the service learning, while that's not an apprenticeship, is a way to instill motivation and inspiration in the younger kids, not maybe as an apprentice, but as a service learning volunteer kind of program. And so, you know, it's really exciting to see some of these opportunities come to fruition, perhaps. So thank you.
It is, Mr. Chair. Perhaps the other Mr. Chair, when he gets back into his seat, as we have too quick of a session to really deal with it this year, but to really have a presentation about that German system. It isn't, when I went, I thought the same thing, it's complete tracking. It really isn't. It's a wonderfully flexible program. But what they do with precision is have these standards
designed with the union employees, with the chambers of commerce, and with the educators working together. And so that's really what this bill is getting at. Let's get those people who really know that trade together and write the standards so we can move forward with some of these. So thank you very much. I think it's interesting, and this committee could benefit from a larger discussion maybe next year.
And Representative Norton, if I could, I'd have a quick question on line 2.1, and you just started to touch on that. I was looking at the establishment of competency standards. Mm-hmm. Has there been discussion that a vision that we need to do something different in our education system up through the process now, and I'm just interested in your feedback on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Interesting you should mention that. Our school district, who wants to move forward with this particular program, has found a barrier actually in our K-12 system that needs to be addressed in making certain that as we create these standards, if it does go down into a high school, that the standards that we have for our high school students can be met in an internship or apprenticeship experience. And so we have our work cut out for us. I believe there is a door open in current statute to do that, but that is something that we will be exploring as we move forward, which is one of the reasons we're taking this in steps with these new trades. But yes,
thank you.
It's very important.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Norton? Well, thank you very much, and I just renew the motion that the House File 2933 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, we're waiting for Chair Mahoney, who's presenting another bill, so we will take a 5-minute recess.
Mr. Chair, maybe some of us can present.
Have fun, don't go too far. Okay, I won't pound the gavel. Go ahead.
You present it?
There he is.
Okay.
There we go.
He's done it for me. I can only
the recess is over.
This is the unfair.
Is that Mahoney?
Yeah, but I'd like to put this down.
I didn't even have time to eat that chocolate yet. That's a good thing. Anywhere.
You want to have mine?
That's all your stuff, yeah. Okay.
It's your own ability. In there.
Okay. There you go. What are we looking at? Your sweetheart. Representative Mahoney. House File 2976. And we are this, we're going to move that this House File 2948 be considered for referral to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the obsolete and redundant statutes. I think I have an A2 amendment.
Mm-hmm.
A3. No, A3.
John, we could have done this. You and I could please.
No problem.
Proceed here. Just a second here. We have an A. Was there an A2?
No, A3. It is. Both?
We're looking for the A3.
It's in there.
Okay, we and it's only the A3.
Yeah.
Please proceed.
We've got to get it. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Yes, please proceed.
Could we adopt the A3 amendment?
Well,
Okay, sure. If you'd, let me get in front of me here. Okay, so does everybody have the A3 amendment? And all in favor of adopting the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the commissioner is here. I believe she wanted to say a few words about the particular bill.
Representative Mahoney, I'm advised that we would also put the A2 on.
We what?
That we would put the A2 amendment on.
I just found the A2 amendment.
I'll move the A2 amendment for consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Discussion on that? All in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is the obsolete and redundant statute. I'm going to just ask the commissioner to go after it. Go right ahead.
Okay. Please proceed, Commissioner. Introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Katie Clark Sieben, the Commissioner of Deed. Pleasure to be here with you this evening. So we are proposing these statutes be repealed as a part of the governor's uncession in making the government better, simpler, faster for Minnesotans. So I'll just walk you through the key statutes. Please let me know if you have any questions. So first, the Environmental Coordination Procedures Act, and I will mention that the statutes that were identified, we believe, are out of date, no longer in use, do not have funding attached to them, so we believe these are the low-hanging fruit statutes that can be reduced. And the sheet that you have in front of you gives you some definition as to why we thought each one could be reduced. So Environmental Coordination Procedures Act, this was passed in 1976, establishes an alternative process for businesses navigating many different state permitting processes at the same time. The reason why we believe this can be repealed is that we now have the Minnesota Business First Act that is in place. The staff is meeting every other week. The commissioners meet once a month and is meeting with businesses for this very purpose. First Act was created in 2012 and has been very well received by businesses. Second on the list, e-commerce ready designations. Established in 1999, is a leftover from the dot-com boom. Only one local government is known to have ever participated in this program, and there's no current demand for such a designation. Third, Rural Policy and Development Center Fund establishing language. This language created a trust benefiting the Rural Policy and Development Center. The 2002 legislature transferred all funds out of the trust, effective in 2005, and this language has simply not been revisited since that transfer. And eliminating the statute will not affect the Center for Rural Policy and Development's current pass-through funding or change anything about its operations. Fourth, Science and Technology Economic Development Project. This language established a one-time collaborative project in 1999. That project eventually led to the creation of the now-repealed Science and Technology Authority. None of these are active, and there is no funding attached. Number five, Minnesota Entrepreneur Resource Virtual Network. This program has been replaced by the online business portal project that Minute is currently focused on, and other e-government work underway by Minute. Number six, advisory board meetings. In 2009, the legislature undertook an effort to allow all departmental boards to meet by telephone or electronically. This subdivision was drafted as part of that process. The key here is that the Small Business Development Center Board operates under federal law and is not subject to any state advisory or administrative board requirements. So just excessive language. Seven, license assistance exceptions. This statute clarifies deed is not required to provide assistance related to a specific list of licenses and permits. This clarification is no longer necessary. Environmental permits on the list are now addressed by the Minnesota Business First Stop. Licensing boards provide all assistance pertaining to occupational licenses they oversee. Number eight, affirmative enterprise program. This program, established to encourage full-time employment of persons with disabilities, has not been funded since 1995. Other programs, primarily DEED's Vocational Rehabilitation Program, provide similar services. Number nine, Biomedical Innovation and Commercialization Initiative. This language, passed in 2001, established a one-off collaborative project to capitalize on the growth of the biomedical industry. The legislature canceled the appropriation for the program in 2002. However, many of the functions are now carried out by the University of Minnesota. Number 10, the Board of Invention. This board is no longer active. Since this legislation passed in 1993, the Minnesota Inventors Congress has become the primary organization promoting invention and inventors in Minnesota. DEED has awarded several rounds of competitive grant funding to that organization, including a $170,000 award in the fall of 2013. Number 11, Higher Education Loan Program. This program is no longer active. However, the Job Skills Partnership and several of other DEED's programs continue to provide a variety of training assistance to employers. It was passed in 97, a total of $150,000 awarded, and two grants were made, one in 2000 and one in 2004. Number 12, Healthcare and Human Services Worker Program. This was originally funded by TANF. No further grants have been awarded since that funding was exhausted. This language is also unnecessary since this activity can also be funded under the Job Skills Partnership or DEED Career Pathways Programs. Youth Build Advisory Committee. The legislature now provides funding directly to Youth Build in the form of pass-through grants administered by DEED. This advisory group is no longer necessary. The language dates back to 1988 and now is a fully funded operational organization. Number 14, Local Service Delivery. These functions are related to a county service delivery planning process that has long since been replaced. And in this new system, DHS is handling those responsibilities. 15, Transit Improvement Areas. This program has never been funded and almost exactly duplicates Met Council's well-funded transit-oriented development program. DEED's redevelopment grant program often works with the TOD program to cover certain costs associated with transportation projects, and the SSBCI programs can also provide assistance in this area in certain cases. And then the final two, 16, area redevelopment. This section consists of legislative findings passed in 1987 that very generally encourage economic development and partnerships between local and state governments. We see that this is simply policy language that doesn't have a real impact and could be eliminated. And finally, 17, city development districts. Again, passed in 1987, encourages cities to engage in economic development but isn't having a real impact and could be reduced. And then not on the spreadsheet, we do have two items that are language changes, not repeals. And so I'm not sure if you want that separate or want me to walk through them now.
Which ones were they?
UI cost bonds and UI record retention.
Isn't that what we did on... We'll go ahead.
Okay. So the final two that are... language changes. So first, UI cost bonds. The Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure will be amended by the Supreme Court effective July 1st. As part of that revision, the court is eliminating cost bonds on all appeals. This will come into conflict with Chapter 268 because the current UI statute requires a cost bond from employers and statutes trump court rules. Without this change, a UI appeal would likely be the only type of case which would require a cost bond, despite the fact the cost bonds serve no real purpose in UI appeals. And the final one is UI record retention. This section reduces wage detail record-keeping requirements for businesses statewide from 8 years to 4 years. This change will still allow Deed to collect all the information it needs for the UI program while cutting back on paper requirements that apply to 120,000 employers statewide. I just want to call out that particular language change because this is a significant change for businesses across the state in reducing the amount of paperwork and the amount of storage that they need to keep with employee files on site.
Mr. Chair?
Representative?
I believe the amendment that we put on took some of that out, and if I could ask staff to tell me which ones that took out of those last two.
Please.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, that A2 amendment removed the language related to the record keeping, the 8 year to 4 year change, because that is in that more comprehensive unemployment insurance bill. So that's okay,
thank you.
Taken out.
And if I might, Mr. Chair,
to
Ms. Newman, where was the other piece on the UI bonds in the bill?
Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, the bond language that the commissioner was referring to is still in the bill. It's in Section 1 on page 1 of the bill, so the amendment didn't affect that. And then the amendment language on the records and the audits maintained paragraph A on page 2.
Yep.
Lines 223 to 227. The amendment basically removed the changes beginning on line 28 of page 2.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or from members? Seeing none. Anybody in the audience looking to testify here? Come on down.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself for the record, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Charlie Vanderetti for Metro Cities. I'll be brief. Metro Cities, the League of Minnesota Cities, and the Economic Development Association have some concerns with repealer of the transit improvement area language. That's on lines 420 and 421. Metro Cities strongly advocated for the language when it became law in 2008, and a number of cities have separately indicated their support of keeping the language in statute. The language is important because it defines the criteria for transit-oriented development, and additionally, the Metropolitan Council uses transit improvement area designation when reviewing livable communities grant awards. So we've reviewed these concerns with the department and thank them for their consideration, and we'll continue to work with the commissioner and her staff as we move forward. So thank you.
Thank you. Any further, any folks that would like to further comment on the bill? Seeing none, no more questions from members. Like to move to re-refer House File 2948 as amended in the General Register.
Mr. Chair.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill's passed. As amended. Representative Mahoney, then to tell
which
us.
Which one would you like next, Mr. Chair?
2740, please.
That works just fine for me. We'll get the commissioners and the insurance companies out of here early tonight. Mr. Chair,
please
I
proceed.
I'm not sure. I have to ask, where is this one going to, the floor?
We're going to lay it over for all conclusion.
Right. Then I would move for consideration House File 2740.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sit on the Work Comp Advisory Board as part of my duties at the Capitol. I don't know if you have the Labor and Industry Workers' Compensation Medical Cost Reimbursement Study in your folders. If you would turn to page 20. I don't know, the one, two, three, fourth paragraph down under, or second paragraph under item number six, insurance administrative cost, the very last line. The loss ratios reported by insurers vary dramatically from a low of 12% to a high of 97%. What that statement means, or what this bill does, is on line 1.18, provides that insurers' expected administrative expenses do not exceed 20% of the insurer's expected total revenue. Members, our workers' comp insurers, some of them do a great job. Administrative costs at 12%, which is good. I have nothing but praise for people like that, or organizations and companies like that. But to have a 97% administrative cost, so that means that 97 cents out of every dollar that they are taking in on workers' compensation is being spent on administrative costs, and 3 cents out of every dollar is being spent on workers, injured workers. The insurance companies, they've tried to give me a good reason, and I'm sure they're going to come up tonight and try to give me a good reason, but it never really kind of made sense to me. So what my bill does is say that these work comp insurers cannot go over 20% for the administrative costs, flat out. If you can't make 20%, I'm not sure the business is a good business to have in this state. I mean, I'm pretty frosted about this one. I can't believe that they do that to workers. So, members, that's what the bill does. It requires all work comp insurance companies in the state of Minnesota to hit a 20% mark.
It's not just workers' bill.
And I'm sure there's people that want to testify against or for this.
It's insurance.
Thank you. And can I ask for testifiers here? We have a short list. Mary Pinky, please come down. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. And it's really nice to be here tonight. I spend most of my time up in Health and Human Services, so it's kind of nice to see some new faces for me. So in December of 2013, and I see Commissioner Peterson is here as well. They're all here. In December of this past year, the department, Dolly, came out with their report that Representative Mahoney was referring to. It was called the Workers' Compensation Medical Cost Reimbursement Study. And to be honest with you, the hospital sort of braced ourselves because we thought that the overall focus would be just on the medical costs in the workers' compensation program. And we were actually very pleased to see that the report was very balanced and also talked about the administrative costs in the workers' compensation program. And I would like for members to understand that if we can reduce the administrative costs in the workers' compensation program, then the healthcare providers can reduce their costs as well. So it can actually be a win-win situation, whereas if we can take some of the administrative costs out of how we process claims, we might be able to charge less as well. And I'd like to give you an example of that. A couple of years ago, the Hospital Association offered up a deeper discount in the workers' compensation program if we could get what was called PET, predictability of payments, electronic claims processing, and timeliness of payments. And I would like to just comment on three specific things that were in the report that I think highlight that PET program, or the PET idea that we had. This is in the report. Electronic transmissions and payment of medical bills has been slow to take hold in Minnesota's workers' compensation system. Commercial payers are in compliance with e-billing. Work comp carriers are not. Bill reviewers are the largest cost component of an insurer's workers' comp medical payment system, 43%. These are the companies that take items on a provider's bill and scratch them off. So they're spending a lot of money reviewing the hospital's bills and taking them off of the bill. And the last one I want to mention, in the report it said that 35% of inpatient claims go to disputed litigation. And the department commented that that was really unrealistic and way too high. So if you think about it, hospitals are having to hire attorneys, go to litigation to get paid what is rightfully a claim that should be paid. This stretches out the payments. It means that the payments aren't timely, and there really is a lot of built-in inefficiency in the system. So we would like to be able to reform the system, take some of those administrative costs out, and we believe in the long run we think that we'll be able to have premium savings for the purchasers of work comp insurance as well. So, with that, we would just like to comment that we support what Representative Mahoney is trying to do with this bill. Under the Affordable Care Act, I don't know if you all are familiar with that, but the insurance companies have to meet a 20% threshold in order to be eligible for the subsidy. So we think this 20% mark is really a valid number. Also, our health plans here in Minnesota operate at about a 10% efficiency. Some of them do better than that. So our HMOs are doing better than 10% with their efficiency. We don't think this 20% is too hard to meet. So thank you.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
This bill would lower the cost to employers, and I would certainly welcome a smart legislator with an amendment that said that all those lowered costs have to go to the employers. But that's just, you know, something I would except if somebody wanted to put that on. But I'm sure there's other testifiers here.
I'm just wondering if we, Representative Mahoney and the testifier, if we want to have questions of testifiers now or wait to the end if anybody's going to take off.
Mr. Chair, I don't think anybody's going to be real long-winded with this particular bill. That's a hint. And all three or four of the testifiers will stick around, and they can.
So if we have questions in a bit,
I think the people I'm waiting to talk to, I haven't even talked yet. So,
did you want to hold? I had your name down. Did you want to hold off, Representative Metza?
Yeah, I'll hold off.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
And next on my list is Bob Johnson. Please have a chair and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, and I represent private work comp insurers selling in the state. And I'd like maybe just to initially answer Chairman Mahoney's question about the number and the study and assure him and the committee there is no work comp insurer in the state that's operating with 97 cents of expenses out of the dollar. The loss ratio, Mr. Mahoney, represents the amount paid out in claims. So from 12 to 97. And
oh, you're correct.
Expenses, and so that there's nobody. So just so the committee knows that that's not how to read those numbers.
Mr. Chair, it's 88% operating costs versus.
And that number actually changes over time because work comp, and maybe I can do it this way, a couple of comments about this expense pie issue, and then a couple of comments out of the study, and I know you don't want to go over the whole study, but there's some really important parts of the medical cost study that make all of these issues tie together. The work comp insurer's expenses, hospital expenses, system expenses. But I think just on the issue of work comp insurer's expenses, because I think the notion here that's being testified is that what happens in major medical should be applicable to workers' compensation. It's not, and it shouldn't. The two lines, how they're operated, the types of expenses that need to and are incurred in the work comp system bear no resemblance to the major medical system. I work with commercial health insurers, so we're familiar with the differences. And so to say that it's a comparable or it should be applied, it's just, it's not, from our perspective, it doesn't fit. It's an apple and an orange. And here's why. I mean, our workers' compensation market is decidedly different than major medical. We've got, in health insurance, three companies. It's an oligopoly market that write about 90% of the business. We have over 300 private work comp insurers that sell in this state in a highly competitive market. And just let me just identify some of the expenses. So in the work comp system, agent commissions, so the local independent agent in all your districts that are selling the product to employers, it's somewhere from 7 to 10%. In the major medical arena, agent commissions are probably 1 to 3. And the commissions were ratcheted back down. I think if any of you talk to agents in your districts, the Affordable Care Act cut back income to independent agents in this state dramatically. So whether that was right or wrong, I'm just telling you that, that that's one of the factual differences. This whole issue of litigation expenses, claim adjustment, loss adjustment expenses, the major medical world has nowhere near the number of litigation adjudication issues that you see in the workers' compensation system about having to prove that it happened on the job. In a major medical arena, once you identify the person where they work, and you've got a health insurance card, you can pay the claim. It's pretty simple. And so in the work comp system, there's litigation expenses somewhere in the 8 to 10%. So lawyers, both plaintiff and defense lawyers, there's a lot of litigation that's in the system. So there's a chunk of expenses, and I'm just it's decidedly different than major medical. Work comp insurers in this state have taxes, license, and fees of about 4 to 4.2%. So there's a chunk of state-imposed taxes that have nothing to do with our expenses, of slightly over 4%. And then the issue of this line of insurance, so health insurance claims pretty much all arise and are decided within a 12-month period. Work comp cases enter the system and often can be in the system for 30 years. So the number that Mr. Mahoney pointed out, it changes over time. So in early years, the loss payout is lower. So if you look at the payout in year one or two, it's not a clear picture of the payout because the payout's going to grow from that year over a long period of time. So again, the point is that the lines of insurance are so dramatically different that just you can't do a heads-up comparison and say, well, this is here and so this should be here. It's not going to be there. The systems simply don't have the same components. The other issues in the work comp system that are not part of major medical, I mean, we've got return to work costs. We have quite a few dollars that payroll audit expenses. There's functions that are in the work comp system, each of which contributes to the numbers. The expenses of the private work comp insurers in Minnesota are no different than the expenses of the private work comp insurers in Wisconsin and Florida and the 44 states that have private work comp insurers, six do not. And yet, these states, you'll see premium variations that spread a wide gamut. So the insurer expenses are the same. Why are premiums a lot cheaper in Wisconsin and some other states than they are in Minnesota? And they're cheaper because the system payouts are different. And that's driven by the law. And so maybe I'll end with just returning back to the department's report. And I know that this is not before the committee, but I know it was handed out. And I think it's very, very important, members, for you to know what Commissioner Peterson and his outside experts, this was not written by our industry. It was not put together by us at all. And that's fine. That's what I know the legislature wanted Commissioner Peterson to do. But I think if I could turn your attention to page 2 of the report, here's some really salient, important comments that need to be pointed out. A, what the commissioner and the outside experts said is that the current Minnesota system does not provide, it's in the second to the last paragraph, any control over services not provided by a fee schedule. All right, so fee schedules in the Minnesota work comp system cover doctors, providers. They do not cover hospitals. Because Minnesota's system incentivizes higher medical charges, results in higher costs to payers because of line-by-line bill review creates delays in payments and creates an environment ripe for disputes. This is not a very good description, and this is what Minnesota employers are paying for. And what I'm here to testify to, Mr. Chairman, is that because of the deficiencies and the flaws and the inadequacies in the current system in Minnesota, the numbers I'm talking about of dispute costs, they're a lot higher because the system is encouraging the disputes and the litigation. The system encourages, with the current hospital, which is no control, then if you could turn to page... Well, it's under the reimbursement methodology, and just to emphasize what this outside expert looking at the Minnesota system said, what the outside expert says is that the Minnesota charge-based system provides no control over costs, none.
Mr. Chair, to that point, where are you at in the report?
It's under the section called reimbursement methodology, and it's under background current reimbursement system. I hit page. I'm actually into the report under the section entitled reimbursement methodology, and
which did you have a page number
page
for?
Four, if I have page four. I think this is the final copy. But if you turn to that, and you'll see the effect of the charge-based system, and I'll be done in a minute, Mr. Chairman. I just want to flag because it's...
Representative Fabian, did you find it on page four? It's from the front of the study. It's page four, down in the lower right-hand corner. Yeah. It'll have reimbursement methodology. I think it's the second paragraph down, isn't it?
Yeah. So the point is that I just am pointing out the conclusions of Commissioner Peterson's outside expert, who's an expert firm in medical cost containment systems and programs. So in other words, our current law provides no control over costs, none. And that's for hospitals in Minnesota. They noted that nationwide hospital charges are three times higher than hospital costs. So we have a charge-based system, and it's a system that encourages hospitals to bill in a way that generates an expensive system that insurers have to respond to, because that's what the system is. So services are unbundled so that maximizing charges and payments that hospitals are collecting, we're paying, and that most importantly employers in the state are paying for. So what I'm saying, Mr. Chairman and committee members, is that you have to look at what's going on in the system, and what's going on in the system is a significant contributor. On the front page of the executive summary of the report, in fact, it says bill reviewers are the largest cost component of insurers' work time medical payment system. So why are bill reviewers there? Bill reviewers are there because the current Minnesota system incentivizes hospitals to break down charges. We don't have what most of us are familiar with, the diagnostic-related group, DRGs, something that actually helps contain the cost. Because we don't do that, insurers are literally forced, in my opinion, to load up on costs. If we adopted a DRG system, which maybe would be a friendly amendment to your bill, Mr. Chairman, a DRG system for work comp, then you could jettison those tens of millions of dollars that we pay today because the system we have to pay. We'd be happy to support a DRG. That'd be a friendly amendment to the bill. And work comp systems around the country, which Commissioner Peterson points out, do DRGs. Why? Because it works. Work comp systems around the country do put caps on surgical implants. And there's a whole section in here analyzing implants. And if you looked at that, Commissioner Peterson noted we are one, maybe two states out of all the states that provide no caps on surgical implants, and the commissioner notes the percentage markup on surgical implants, and the point of that is that that markup is what we translate to employers, and they're paying that in their premiums. And so the bottom line, and I'll close with, we're fully engaged and want to work with you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee, and Commissioner Peterson, and the document that outlines a number of issues that have to be dealt with. House File 2740 is an axe on this one piece. It is a piece of the overall report and study that needs to, and is part of it. It's on the table. But by axing one piece of it, and then not addressing what's generating a lot of the expenses, it's not going to work, in our opinion, to solve the problem. The problem is still there. And now we've got no cost controls on that part of the system. And that's the fastest growing part of medical costs in the work comp system is hospital. And that's what Commissioner Peterson, the fastest growing component, not doctor's charges. And the reason is that is that there's a fee schedule in the Minnesota law for doctor's charges that's working, and the hospitals are skating above that. So, Mr. Chairman, we just opposed the bill. This is a slice at one piece. And there's a lot of pieces that have to be a part of it. This is not going to fix the problems in the Minnesota system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I understand, and we're going to move on to Commissioner Peterson, and then we've got a list of questions going here. But if
and just as Commissioner Peterson comes down, I just want my colleagues on this particular committee, Mr. Peterson can come down while I mention this, is that this is not a new issue. Everyone that comes to the table to talk tonight has been a piece of the problem. Maybe not this particular commissioner, but the commissioner, the office of commissioner, the workers' comp board, the insurers, the hospitals, the scrubbers. And I think this is the first time this has actually been talked about in a committee.
Commissioner Peterson, introduce yourself, please, and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. As you can see, there's a spirited discussion on this issue. We did. The legislature ordered us to do this report that Chairman Mahoney mentioned, the reimbursement, and we did a report on it. We finished the report in January and made a report to the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, and that's what caught the eye of Representative Mahoney and why he brought his bill when he did our presentation. I assume that's what happened. Over the years, we've looked at this issue occasionally. We do a workers' comp system report every year, and there we come back every year saying that roughly the costs, administrative costs, are somewhere in around the 30% area. And this one, we looked at 1 year, and we found out the costs were a little more, that somewhere around 40%. But we're looking at, I have to say, that we surveyed 20 insurance companies, and this one question, we got responses from 13. I don't know if they were the larger insurance companies or smaller insurance companies. So the data isn't quite all there, I can assure you that. At the same time, this is a cause of concern for us, that we think that it's something worthwhile looking at. The members of the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council are very interested in this issue as well as the medical cost issue. So what we're doing right now is we're trying to work with the hospitals and the insurers to come up with some solutions to this problem. Hopefully, they'll be able to give one to the Workers' Comp Advisory Council and next fall, and bring it to the legislature next summer or next winter in this next session to take some steps to bring it down the hospital costs as well as bringing down the cost of administration of the workers' compensation system. That's our goal. The bill that Representative Mahoney has, though, does not necessarily fall within the realm of the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council because it goes to the Department of Commerce, which regulates the charges made by insurance companies, and our department doesn't. So the practice has been that bills related to Chapter 176, which is a workers' comp law, go through this advisory council. This one would not necessarily have to, as he well knows. But we are trying to solve this problem. We're trying to address it as best we can, sitting down with people, and we're expecting some proposals from the hospital side soon, and we're also working on some of our own, and we've discussed it with the insurance industry as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think we're prepared to open it up for questions. Let's do that. The testifiers, that make yourselves ready. I presume there's questions potentially for Mary Krinke and then Bob Johnson. And let's begin. And Representative, you're first on list. Who was your question to or comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to talk to the hospital folks and the insurance folks.
Okay.
Let's get another chair.
Or two.
Mr. Johnson.
Or two.
Okay.
I got all my
stuff. We have Ms. Trinke and Mr. Johnson available. Please proceed, Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'll start with the hospitals. Do you know what the number one cause of bankruptcy in this country is?
Mr. Chair and Representative Metzen, I believe the last time I saw that, it was medical bankruptcy due to medical expenses.
Thank you, Ms. Trinke. Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, aside from all the big words and things used that we talked about with, you know, the language, I guess, that you described to your colleagues in a different field, so my constituents can understand back home, kind of what we're talking about here is an egregious waste of taxpayer money. And so, you know, or our, well, taxpayers who are paying into this insurance money. Bottom line, at the end of the day, we've got 88%, was it, that it got corrected to in that? So 88% of the fees that you're collecting are going to, and this kind of both of you can answer if you want, but 88% of the money that you're collecting is going out to suit your own selves and not going back to the people who basically are getting the services.
And to whom is that? Is that Representative Metzen, the question directed to?
I guess we could go with Mr. Johnson on that.
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's I think as you described that number, take a step back. Let me just explain it. Answer it this way. So if you look at the dollar that an employer pays in premium, where does it go? Mm-hmm. If you start with that, we could do a pie. There is a percentage, well, there's a lot of pies in the report. So anyway, so a chunk of it goes to the insurers in terms of the overhead. So Mr. Mahoney's talked about that, but the benefits that go to the workers, they really are two categories: the indemnity benefits, that's the wage replacement benefits. So that's, you know, the worker who is out of job, and they'll get temporary total benefits, temporary partial, permanent total, permanent partial. There's four categories, but they also get their medical care provided for. So it's not paid to them, but it's paid to a provider who's giving them the care that the work comp system requires. So I think that if you could look at it that way, a majority of the dollars are going to the injured worker or the care for the injured worker. I think that's a fair statement. The numbers are what they are. I don't have the pie charts here. So a majority of the dollars go to the injured worker either in direct wage replacement, that'll go to them personally, or to pay for their provider's health care services. And the work comp system pays 100% lifetime of whatever those bills are. So if it's a 30-year claim, the medical bills are paid for 30 years, and the work comp insurer, or if they're self-insured, will pay that. Does that at least help maybe paint the picture of the dollars?
Yeah, that makes sense. And Mr. Chair, so I guess kind of what I'm concerned about is we've got a lot of money that basically what I'm hearing from you is their fault, and what I'm hearing from them is partially your fault. And so you're raising the price of the bills and putting things in there in a line item, and then you're going through and crossing them out on a line. And I guess I'm confused as to why maybe this discussion, and thank you, Representative Mahoney, for bringing it to the committee. I'm confused why we haven't dealt with this before.
Ms. Kinky.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I really would like to put hospital costs in a little bit of perspective. I don't know if you're familiar with the Dartmouth Atlas, which is an analysis of hospital costs under the Medicare system nationwide. And under that analysis, Minnesota has some of the lowest health care costs in the country. And that is precisely why the rates on the exchange were lower than other states. And so I do think it is important that we put this in a little bit of perspective nationwide, that Minnesota healthcare costs are some of the lowest in the country. I also would like to comment, if I may, on something that Mr. Johnson said about the rising healthcare costs and being at hospitals. Well, if you have the indemnity side, that's the money that's paid to the injured worker. If that's frozen, okay, then by definition, the premiums on the other side are going to go up relatively if the other side of the equation is frozen. And quite frankly, actually spending money on health care services can potentially get the injured worker back to work more quickly, and that may save money on the indemnity side as well. And I think it's important to note that in Minnesota, as we have an aging population and aging workforce, when our workers are injured, the costs of those injuries are fairly significant. So the days of just sort of a minor injury don't happen as much, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to pass this news article out. The number of claims has fallen dramatically. We have a very efficient and very good workers' compensation system. So this discussion today is really about how do we take a good system and make it better. But I don't want to leave the impression that we have a bad system here in Minnesota. The number of claims have fallen 43% since 1997. So we have a pretty good system in place. What Representative Mahoney is trying to do is make it a little bit better.
Representative Metcha.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And kind of what I wanted to lead in, I believe last year I carried a bill that raised that cap up so we could actually cover the costs because we were hitting a threshold that exceeded the amount that needed to be paid for certain employees that needed to take advantage of the insurance. And, you know, I guess my concern would be if we're raising that cap and there's still, you know, the back and forth, I guess I'll keep it short by saying I really hope you're back here together supporting a bill that would help eliminate some of these costs. And in a safer seat, if I make it through my next election cycle, I'd be more than happy to help with that.
Thank you. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have a proposed amendment I would hope Representative Mahoney would accept. On page 1 of the bill, on line 1.19, after the period, I'd like to insert, of the revenue saved through this effort, and I want to applaud the commissioner for his report, half of that revenue be given to the insured. Those people pay for the work comp insurance premium, and half of it get paid, it goes to the injured worker. And I wonder if Anita could probably put that in a little better form and report that to the committee. But that way we have both parties benefiting from this, and I think it's very important to have that done, and there will be much more peace in the valley.
Ms. Newman, when you're ready, just give a sign. Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther, the amendment would be on page 1, line 19, after the period, insert of any revenue savings as a result of this change, 50% shall go to the insured parties, and 50% shall be returned to injured workers.
That's pretty
important. That's a friendly amendment, Mr. Chair.
I heard the amendment. Do we have discussion on the amendment? Did everybody understand what the amendment says? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just a point of clarification. You said 50% would go to the Insureds?
Insured, I believe she... Maybe she'll repeat it one more time. Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair, that is what Representative Gunther said, so if he means...
The person who's paying the policy.
Be the employer.
Employer. Who is the insured, I believe.
They are the insured, eh? Okay. Representative Albright.
Ms. Newman, would it not be the policy owner?
Same thing, I think.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I would defer to some of the insurance experts in the room because this is beyond my terminology. So,
Mr. Chair, just from experience, the beneficiary may be an employee of an employer who is paying the premium on behalf of the employee. And so in the context of that, the employee really is not the recipient of the benefit other than being rehabilitated. The employer, though that he is, they are the ones paying the premium on the policy, so thereby they should receive 50% of the proceeds as opposed to the employee. It is to the policy owner that the 50% should go.
Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the term we might want to use is policyholder. Person who owns the policy, policyholder.
Yes. I believe Representative Albright suggested that, something close to that. Also, but there are two entities, policyholder and what was the other one?
Policy owner. Mr. Chair and members, the 50% would be to the policy owner. Then and then 50% would be to the injured worker.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not looking to help this at all, but just to explain. I mean, it is important to understand it. Work comp insurers have to file their rates with the Commerce Department. It has to be approved. If, and this is a component of rates, so if all rate filings have to be refiled, then the savings would be reflected in the filed rates, and that's what employers pay. So that's how the system works. This bill doesn't change the rate filing requirements. We have to file rates. They have to comply with all state laws. No insurer in this state operates at a 20% administrative expense, none, and they don't anywhere in the country. So, but we had that argument. So this notion of checks doesn't fit. It literally doesn't fit the system. If insurers' rates are refiled, then the Commerce Department won't let them put anything in on expenses other than what the law says. The rest of the rate filing is the benefits that injured workers get. So that piece of it stands by itself. So refunds just don't fit that. They would have to refile the rates. The rates would have to be in accordance with this expense component if it's law. And if insurers are at 38% expense, and that's in the current rate, and it goes to 20, then that rate's going to drop by that component. So the employers get the benefit of the lower rate, and the refunds is just simply not part. It actually wouldn't work in the current system. There's no way you could cut checks off of a provision like this and actually have try to get that back to, because it doesn't fit the system.
Representative Mahoney.
Members, I think you now understand what the work comp board is dealing with and what the injured workers, the policyholders, and everyone else. I certainly believe, and I apologize to the members if you feel like I may have wasted your time, but this is a serious message to the board. This bill does not need to go through the board. This only needs to go through Commerce. And I don't think there's anyone on this committee that wouldn't vote for this bill in one form or another with a few tweaks. So to the board members that are here, because they are here, to the commissioner, to the people that are involved in this work comp issue, this is a message, because whether the Democrats or the Republicans are in charge next year, once this genie's out of the bottle, they know about it. We all know about it, and we can tell the people that work in our communities about it and our employers about it, and they will be upset. So, Mr. Chair, rather than waste any more time with the committee with a message bill, I'm going to pull this bill and ask that you return it to the author.
Yes.
Yes, we'll do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sir, good
morning. I have a great question.
Well, you left a lot of people at the altar with questions, but we'll,
I know I did.
We'll.
But I wanted to get us out of here before 10:30.
I'm on 8.
Representative Norton, we've got one more. Representative Mahoney, House File 2976. I'll bring this bill before us for layover for possible inclusion. And Representative Norton, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt the real other chair's meeting, but before the department folks left, Commissioner? Okay, it's fine.
Mr. Peterson?
We had a discussion earlier while the other chair wasn't in the room about the trip to Germany, and lest people leave here with a false assumption. I wanted to be clear, the commissioner was also with us as well as other people in this room. No state funds for Representative Mahoney or myself were used in the travel for that trip. It was funded by the country of Germany and organized by the University of Minnesota.
I had to pay my own way.
And we had to pay our own way on the flight. So I just wanted folks to know that it was a joint venture and no state funds were used so that people didn't go crazy and talk about it outside this room. In a false way, because I didn't clarify that during my testimony.
Thank you,
testimony.
Representative Norton, and a bunch of folks have to take their tweets back, so so you just raised a ruckus, but that's okay. Thank you.
Mine just turned.
Get a new phone.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, we have a number of people in the audience that are going to want to testify on this, so we'll get right to it.
A couple amendments.
Yes, there are. And I would like to move House File 2976 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
And please proceed in A1 or A2 amendment. I have two of them, it looks like.
We'll start with the... I'm going to ask staff, does one have to follow... Go first? Okay. Then we'll go with the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
And
Mr. Chair, this is just shrinking the scope of the bill. So the fiscal note won't give me heartburn.
And we'll
someday
get the A1 in front of us. And does everybody have a copy of the A1? So all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So we got the A1 on, and...
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
A2, and everybody got an A2 amendment in front of them? All in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendments are on. Representative Mahoney, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Norton and I have worked on accountability measures in this committee for a while. Frankly, when we tried to compare one workforce training program versus another, and one economic development tool versus another, we typically get a report or some data. More often than not, we are comparing an apple to an orange to a pear to an avocado. It is there's no rhyme or reason to any of this data is reported. I have to thank Representative Gunther. About 15 or 16 or 17 years ago, something like that, he requested has now become called the Gunther Report, and on workforce training. It is spread out over 5 agencies, the last I counted, and it has we have 169 workforce training programs in the state, in state government. And our committee handles maybe 20, 25 of them. we do all the economic development. But what that amendment did is it didn't take out, but I will be taking out the requirement for economic development reporting, because at this time I don't think the department can do it unless we appropriate a substantial amount of money. And what the amendment did is really ratchet this back to doing it on a number of workforce training programs, so that the cost of this is very acceptable to this committee and to the chamber. And if they can do it on a number of them, a smaller number of programs, that roadmap can be used in other areas and other expanding it to all of the workforce training programs. Now, in the original bill, we had vocational rehab, which is certainly an entirely different kind of job training. We had youth build and youth programs in, and the amendment takes most of that out. So what this bill now does is require the department to bring a report, and I think the date is December 31st of the even years, so that it will be available for use as we try to create a budget. So if Workforce Training Program A comes in, we can say, this is how do you measure up? And it requires them, anyone applying for a grant or an appropriation, to supply that data in the form that the department will be requesting. And they already are doing some of this with the governor's workforce council. They're doing some, what is it called? The net impact studies. So that's what this bill does. It also calls for an independent evaluation of the work. So what this bill does is call for the department to develop a program that allows us to compare apples to apples on just a few programs, so that we can see if it really does work and we can expand it to all the programs. Mr. Chair, I have multiple testifiers here. I've worked with any number of groups. I want to back this up a little bit and tell you who's been involved in this conversation. Well, obviously the department, obviously Representative Norton and myself, but what we don't realize is that the workforce training in this state, the dollars spent approaches $500 million. Much of it is private employer, but much of it is the philanthropic community. The philanthropic community has the same frustration I do. They don't feel like they have an apples-to-apples comparison, and that's one of the people that has been helping me with this. So, having said that, I would open it up to the testifiers, because this is a bill that I hopefully we can pass this year and put to good use next year when we put the budget together, no matter who's sitting in that chair.
Representative Mahoney, I have one testifier on the list here, Brian Lindsley. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you tonight. My name is Brian Lindsley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Regional Workforce Innovation Network, or MSPWIN. We are a philanthropic collaborative representing 11 regional, statewide, and national funders. MSPWIN seeks a prosperous and equitable Minnesota where businesses have the skilled workers they need to compete, and all adults have the opportunity to participate in the workforce and advance toward family-sustaining wages. I'm here tonight to speak strongly in favor of House File 2976, specifically the portions that relate to standardized outcome reporting for adult workforce programs and net impact evaluation for adult workforce programs. What is standardized outcome reporting, and why is it important? MSPWIN would like to see fewer, simpler, and more useful reports. As legislators, I know you receive many reports, each with their own definitions and goals. I know this because previously I was the executive director of the Governor's Workforce Development Council and sent this committee many reports. In my role at the GWDC, I was always trying to cut through the confusion of the workforce system. I think we all want to make the workforce system better for participants and for businesses that need skilled workers. One big step in that direction is standardized outcome reporting, which will help us get all literally on the same page. Standardized outcome reporting will reduce confusion through standard definitions. It will also highlight who is being served and help identify the gaps in our adult workforce development system. Minnesota's large employment disparities based on race and gender make reporting on these demographics particularly important. We know that workforce programs are not one size fits all, and it is for exactly this reason that we think standardized outcome reporting is important. It removes the guessing game of what a funder means by a term like credential, and by using state wage data, we can lessen the data collection burden for many organizations around the state. A standardized report will provide a solid baseline for understanding workforce program outcomes. Minnesota's workforce training providers currently collect a wide range of important data about participants and program outcomes. This bill simply asks that the data collected and available be reported in a standard way. Most importantly, it will infuse the workforce development system with transparency. With standard short reports with common definitions, we believe that you will be more informed about the programs you fund. The next step in this process is net impact evaluation. Net impact analysis uses statistical techniques to determine how workforce program participants do relative to similar participants or similar people who did not participate in the program. In other words, it determines whether outcomes are a result of the program itself or would have occurred anyway, even without participating in the program. In 2011, the U.S. Government Accountability Office issued a report on approximately $18 billion used to administer 47 education and training programs across the country. That report stated, "Little is known about the effectiveness of the employment and training programs we identified because only 5 of 47 reported demonstrating whether outcomes can be attributed to the program through an impact study, and about half of all the programs have not had a performance review since 2004. Minnesota statute already requires the development and implementation of a set of standard approaches for assessing the outcomes of workforce programs, including a comparison of program participants to non-participants. The Governor's Workforce Development Council has been conducting a limited net impact pilot evaluation of 3 programs, Dislocated Worker, WIA Adult, and Twin Cities Rise, but progress has been slow, in part due to the reliance on a volunteer economist. We strongly believe that this effort needs to be prioritized and invested in, and this bill does just that. It requires that the results of the pilot program be shared with legislators and expands that evaluation to all adult training programs in the Workforce Development Fund. Without this kind of analysis, Minnesota will be behind peer states in evaluating and improving its workforce programs. We believe it is worth a reasonable investment to help determine the impact we are currently making on our workforce challenges. Like investments in early childhood education, we believe that some successful workforce programs will more than return the state's investment. Net impact will show how workforce outcomes, like getting a job, result in additional tax revenue, reduced benefit spending, and incarceration avoidance. Programs with significant impact will likely pay for themselves. Yet without net impact analysis, we don't know which programs can provide high value to participants and the state. We believe passage of a standardized outcome report card and net impact analysis will result in efficiency, effectiveness, and equity in the adult workforce development system. These are cost-effective strategies that will help training providers reduce duplicative and time-consuming reports, inform program managers about which strategies are the most effective, and will provide legislators with a clearer sense of how our investments across the workforce system are addressing today's challenges and opportunities. It will also tell us how we are meeting the skill needs of employers and closing skill gaps. This bill helps provide more clarity about what is working and for whom. These reporting tools are by no means intended to serve as the only measurement for workforce program success. Rather, they are critical tools to ensure you have objective, reliable information to assist you in making informed funding decisions. We look forward to continuing work with Representative Mahoney, members of the committee, Deed, and other stakeholders to move this forward. Thank you, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsay, and I think perhaps we'll bring up our other testifier and then open it up for questions. Cynthia Bowerly.
Deputy Commissioner.
Deputy Commissioner, indeed. Introduce yourself, please.
Thank you. Proceed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Bowerly. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Development at DEED. Thank you for your time this evening. We just wanted to take a moment to express how we appreciate Representative Mahoney, Representative Norton's work on this measurement issue over the past couple of years. In particular, the UPAM report, which was adopted a couple of years ago, really took great strides in creating these standardized definitions that I think are very helpful. I do want to be clear that the department shares this commitment to measurement. We do a great deal of measurement every day. Our partners in service delivery across the state, including at MWCA, the local workforce service areas, and all of the providers, collect a great deal of data about our participants. And while we may want to create only one standardized report, we do have requirements for continuing to report as we do to the federal funding streams and under state law. For example, the state report that's required, annual report for the dislocated worker services provided. So we will continue to comply with all of those requirements as we work towards presenting this information in a more usable format, in a way that is more accessible to both decision makers here and to members of the public. So we are excited to work with you on this project. I just do want to clarify a couple of things. There is one, there is a uniform standard for credential that we are all using across all of the programs that we house at DEED. Representative Mahoney noted, there are workforce development programs being delivered in other agencies as well. We work closely with those partners as well, particularly at DHS, to deliver employment and training services under SNAP and MFIP. And so it really, in the field, is a uniform system, so individual businesses or job seekers can have service delivery that is comprehensive and collaborative approach to them. We deliver services to a variety of participants. Some are veterans, Minnesotans with disabilities, laid off workers leaving a facility or a plant, and low skill workers who may not have achieved an education attainment that allows them to compete in the marketplace. And we also serve employers who are looking for greater skill development in the employees that they're seeking. And as we come across the retirement wave that we're about to hit, we know that we are going to have a significant labor demand incongruity that we need to face. So we share this commitment to measuring these performance programs. We would love the opportunity to be able to present this in more robust and using technology tools that we don't have today. So we look forward to working with you on the details of how to make this report as accessible as possible and with the resources that we would need to be able to make this presentation. So we'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Then the air goes off, so you don't have to compete.
Representative Norton, you're first on the list.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question. I just have to thank Representative Mahoney. While I should be mad at him for taking my language and changing it, actually it's improving. And I sort of, when I came to the legislature, I
mark
sat through. I know, write
the
that
second.
Down. I served on this committee, and I would be frustrated when I would ask the department, of which none of these people were there, I don't think, I would ask them, so how do you measure which program's successful? And no one could ever answer. They would, or if they answered, they would give me data that was completely different and measured differently than the group that had just been there 15 minutes before, and I was so frustrated. So I started down this path as a naive, you know, new legislator, and it's been rewarding to see the reports come in and the work that's being done. And I can tell you from experience, the department's worked, took it seriously and worked really, really hard and have continued to. And Representative Mahoney has now helped the program mature, is kind of how I look at it. And you have. And taking it to the next level. Yeah. Well, not you, Representative Mahoney. The bill has matured.
Thank you.
And so, you know, I'm really excited to see what comes of this. And I guess my only concern is our budget, and I am certainly hoping that this committee's budget target is going to be enough that we can fund this so that it can be done properly. And I notice there's lots of blanks there, so I'll trust that the chair of the committee will fill those blanks in with a number that can fund it appropriately within our budget target. without cutting any of the programs any of us around the table hope to fund. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I hear there's 68,000 down in Rochester. Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, I've had discussions with the department, and their number, as the bill was originally written, was, although not a hard number, was much larger than what this the target we're going to have would allow. That's why the amendment went in, and I'm really asking them to work with Brian Lindsay's group and the DEED and the philanthropic groups. If we can tighten this up, if we can get it a better direction, because a better direction is what we really need. And I'm committed to trying to find the money to make this happen and maybe hire a full-time economist for, or at least maybe a quarter time and pay the person that's actually doing the work. But that's where we have to go. So there's other questions.
Ms. Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I neglected to provide an update, which you asked me for during our meeting yesterday, on the net impact evaluation that is happening from the GWDC. I was in communication with the staff of the GWDC this morning, and they anticipate that they have preliminary numbers on the three programs that they are working on and plan to have perhaps not the glossy printed report, but a report available by May 1st. And I told them that I would share that information with you, and that they that we needed to meet that deadline. So we'll be back with you in touch about that as well.
Thank you for that, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Mahoney. I appreciate what you're doing in using my job training criteria bill, and your the amount of money you were talking about is pretty much still on from when I was there looking at it. The problem is the Ventura's administration could only see a double-bladed axe, and they wanted to go chop every job training program that didn't measure up to their deals, and they said at least 50% of them. And I think there's only one thing worse than having a bad job training program is having no job training programs. So I appreciate the way you're going about this. I really believe that ultimately there'll be money saved by doing what you're doing, because you're going to find some unnecessary, inefficient, duplicative programs that don't need to be funded. And I think that might be one of the results you're going to have, and I think it will be self-funding eventually.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Gunther, thank you for that. You know, a good chair steals ideas from wherever they possibly can. If it's a good idea, you should always use the power of the chair to move them forward. I'm not overly worried about saving money. I'm overly worried about trying to get somebody a $14, $15, $18, $25 an hour job. And I think this helps us pick the programs that take someone from making a $7 and a quarter, a minimum wage job, to a job that supports a family. And that's really the I think we all, I don't care which side of the table you sit on, I think at the end of the day, that's what we all want. So.
Representative Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to see if you noticed when Representative Norton said young and naive and first-time legislator. I was reading my email. Did she look at me?
I did.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, I would encourage you to send the people who are looking for $15, $18, $20 an hour jobs to Thief River Falls or Rosa. We've got them there.
But do you have luxury apartments for them?
Fish houses and deer stands.
And we still buy them used.
For this, seeing no further questions, I'd like to lay this bill over as amended, House File 2976, as amended for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that ends our agenda.
I think we made it through the list. So, with no further business, we are.